Sharpies.
Man.
On healthcare, the Interim House Committee on Healthcare to order for this 20th day of September. Welcome our newest member of the House. I've invited Representative Salinas to sit with us whenever she has the time, although she has other committee assignments to keep her busy, but welcome.
Thank you.
I need to open the business meeting. Is that right? Yeah. We need to introduce the new committee rules, which are slightly different than the old committee rules for adoption. They're in all of us. Would you give us a comment on how they're different in any way that are important, Mr. Dropper?
Great. Chair Green, like members of the committee, I'd say there's just two things to note in terms of changes. One, are the changes are really trying to make the interim and session rules similar as possible in organization wording. I wouldn't say there's anything substantive in the interim rules for the House compared to what we had in the session.
Can I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move that the committee adopt the committee organizational rules for the interim.
Is there any discussion? Yes, sir.
Do I still get to vote?
Did they take him off the way I asked? Or?
Chair Greenlee, I did not see that reflected in the draft rules.
We are honored to have you vote.
Thank you.
Honored in a big way. Does that make you more in favor of the rules?
Yes, I will support the rules.
Who are you talking to?
Some guy just came in and wanted enough to see.
Looks pretty hairy, and I just wondered, you know. He's been out fighting fires, I think, is an excuse.
That's serving our state and our nation. Is there any objection?
No.
So moved. We have several informational topics to talk about today. There's been a lot happening in our state. We'll preface them with a little discussion. I think the best thing to do to start out is find out what's going on in the Oregon Health Authority is to call up the interim director, Pat Allen, and ask you to bring whoever you want to bring with you, Pat.
Great, thank you.
And welcome in your new role. You were always welcome here in your old role. Very welcome in your new role. You have a little over an hour to orchestrate.
Got it. Well, thank you, Chair Greenlee, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the interim director of the Oregon Health Authority. I'm happy to be here today to help make one of our presentations, and then there are other staff who will present other information as part of our update today. I just want to take the quick moment to say it's been about 2.5 weeks now that I've been on the ground at OHA and had a great opportunity to meet and work with a lot of really talented people, and we're doing a lot of work to do some things to improve our relationships with a number of entities, not least of which includes yourselves. I think we're going to make great progress in trying to focus on the things we need to be focused on as an agency, and we'll talk about some of that work here today. So with that, I'm going to turn to our presentation on the eligibility determination project. This is one of the last echoes of the Cover Oregon circumstance. This is not really probably quite a final report on that, but it's pretty close. And my job here is to give you a couple of pieces of background for this work as we go into it. You'll all recall vividly, I'm sure, as I do, the failure of Cover Oregon at open enrollment in late 2013 led to a manual process to get people signed up for the Oregon Health Plan in that first year. We were then able to transition to a federal platform. In 2015, we began to stand up the One System, which is the system that we use today to do eligibility determinations. But what that caused was a significant body of work that was related to those hand-processed enrollments. We, with federal government approval, suspended the usual redetermination process that occurs annually after after someone enrolls in the system. And Oregon was not unique in that circumstance. A number of states that had similar similar kinds of failures were in that circumstance. We were able to launch the one system on time early in 2016. And that system is now what processes our eligibility determinations. And then we began the process of going back into the backlog of cases that had not been redetermined to do those redeterminations. You've all certainly heard the number 115,000 people that came up during session. That number was the result of a process that was basically looking at a redetermination, figuring out that it was straightforward or that it was in some sense complex. And complex usually had to do with families with mixed qualifications for how they would or wouldn't be on the health plan and those kinds of things. And those essentially got sent to the end of the pile so we could do the simple ones and get the bulk of those determinations done quickly. That left us with 115,000 that needed to be done. The governor directed the agency to complete those redeterminations by the end of August, and that was successfully done. All of those redeterminations have been completed. Now all Oregonians on the Oregon Health Plan are on an annual redetermination cycle. As you'll see a little bit later, data will show you that you know, not only are we on cycle, but that the one system itself does a better job of doing this processing so that the work of this nature tends to be less than it would be over time. You'll see some numbers here in a bit around people no longer eligible for benefits or no longer qualified for benefits. The reason this isn't a final report is there's a portion of those who were found no longer qualified for benefits because they didn't respond. In the ordinary course, they will respond as they go seek treatment or in some other way become aware of their status, and ordinarily a percentage of those are found to be qualified for benefits, and they've got a 90-day retroactive period. And so only after the end of that 90-day retroactive period will we be able to come back to you with a final accounting of what those numbers look like. What I'd like to do now is turn over to John Collins, who's our Health Analytics Director, to pick up the presentation from here.
Thanks. And for the record, my name is John Collins. I'm the Director of the Office of Health Analytics within the Health Policy and Analytics Division of the Oregon Health Authority. And I'll take you through some of the data that Pat just made reference to. This first slide is really just an overview of the health plan in terms of population. It's a map so that you can see within each county the percentage of the population that is part of the Oregon Health Plan. And just as a general reminder, the health plan is serving approximately 1 in 4 individuals within the state at this time. About 85% of those folks are enrolled in a CCO. The Medicaid reform itself has saved state and federal taxpayers roughly $1.3 billion since 2013. There's a good chunk of these individuals who are actually employed at some level, despite still meeting the qualifications for Medicaid. And just in general, the overall economic impact of the Medicaid expansion has generated roughly $2.75 billion in federal funds for Oregon. So back to the cleanup cases, the 115,000 individuals that Pat mentioned earlier. As he noted, there was a lot of these individuals, the cases associated with them for various reasons weren't processed as we were going through the what was referred to as the leveling process over the course of 2016 as we were manually entering folks into the one system. And just in general, this slide lists some of the types of individuals that this included. It included some pregnant members, children under age 1, some non-responders who were connected maybe to an eligible case where the pregnant member with a child was up for renewal. There were some programs within the Medicaid system, such as breast and cervical cancer program, that extended medical and hospital presumptive eligibility that aren't processed through one. Probably a biggest majority of the folks that were left over were based on discrepancies that occur between some of the legacy systems that we had associated with eligibility and the current systems, and those two things not matching up. So they needed to be set aside and explored a little bit more closely. And there were some individuals where the applications for eligibility submitted to one were not complete, and they needed to go back and collect additional information for those folks. So the next slide gives you a demographic overview of folks. And from a demographic point of view, age, gender, ACA, non-ACA, the population itself of the 115 resembled the general Medicaid population at large. So this is what that mainly explains. And on the next slide, what you see is a comparison of the proportion of people who are in some pretty broad eligibility groups, adults, children, people with disabilities, pregnant women, elderly. On the left side of the bar that's labeled people, you can see the percentage or the share of individuals that fit within these categories. And on the right side, what you're seeing is the share of expenditures associated with those folks. And you can see that there is some difference. For example, children makes up still a pretty large portion of the Medicaid population, not as large as it did prior to the expansion. But compared on the spending side, it's a much smaller percentage. It's only 22% compared to the 40% of the population. And there's some variations like that. So, and this leads us over to the next slide, which is a look at the OHP enrollment and forecast. A lot of questions came up when we
skip on.
Oh, did I? Oh, I did. I'm sorry. Backside. Sorry about that. On the next slide, before we get to the forecast, what this is showing is some of the preliminary results of the processing of these 115,000 people. And what you're seeing on the top and the two bars going across is the percentage of the individuals who remained open as of August 31st, which was 52% or around 60,000 folks. And then the percentage of people who were closed as a result of that process as of August 31st, and that was about 48%. And of those folks who closed, who are no longer eligible, are no longer qualified for benefits, roughly 58% of them were no longer qualified due to non-response to the request for additional information through the renewal process, while the remaining 52% of those individuals were deemed no longer qualified after an administrative review. Majority of those individuals were actually referred off to the federal exchange with the information that they provided to see if we could seek health care services for them in other ways. What I wanted to point out, and the reason why I emphasize the fact that these were preliminary numbers, and Pat touched on this as well, is the fact that really we need to wait roughly 90 days or so past August 31st to really get a final tally in terms of what happened with these individuals, because some of them will undoubtedly come back to Medicaid through the retro enrollment process. And the set of bars on the bottom of this slide really give you a good sense for the kind of impact retroactivity can have on the population. The green bars going across for each of these months that are represented in the bar chart basically show you initially how many people were closed in those months as they went through a renewal or redetermination process.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
And by the way, if other people want to ask questions, please do come down. Is there a possibility of doing an intensive sample of that population, going out and finding out specifically why they didn't return their forms?
Chair Greenlick, you mean of the people who did not respond to the renewal request? We can go back and possibly get some more detail in terms of what happened with those, in terms of doing some sort of sample of them and survey or whatever to find out why they didn't respond. That's something that we could certainly explore.
It's very important because there are some assumptions about the size of the form, about the inability to get phone calls, or the hypothesis that they didn't bother enrolling because they know they're not eligible anymore.
Right.
I think it'll be pretty important for us to have a sense of what that population is.
Yeah, the challenge is how to survey people who didn't respond to a survey.
Yeah.
Effectively.
If they owed me money, I'd find them.
And they still might not take your call.
And we struggle to do that, too.
These folks don't owe you money.
But what about people that might have been just lost? You mailed them the thing, and then it comes back in the mail saying not able to be found.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Malmstrom, there are some more levels of detail associated with the non-responders that we can work through the eligibility system and possibly respond back to you on, including maybe the information about wrong addresses and things such as that.
Sorry. Thank you. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. So returning back to...
Hold on a minute.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlick. Thank you for coming and doing this presentation and talking to me earlier. Have you looked at, historically, we've been told by the Oregon Health Authority that 40% of the people covered by Medicaid have jobs. Have you looked at the correlation between the July 1st minimum wage increase and the lack of response? Do you track that at all each year? So each year you're going to get a bump, July 1st increase in minimum wage, which pushes above, there's not an increase in the federal poverty level, and so you get a larger and larger delta of people that aren't qualified. Do you guys track that? And that's on 40% of your population.
40% of the unknown.
Yeah, so the important thing, I wanted to get back a slide to the spending level, and because this really gets into the next slide that John's about to talk about the net effect of all of this on the forecast. And the issue is that the proportion of people affected in terms of their qualification based on income relative to the spending is really different than the people who are on Medicaid who are not there because of an income-based reason. Remember, most of the people who are there are the non-MAGI Medicaid population that are there for age, disability, those kinds of things, and that's where the spending is much more significantly concentrated. So historically, we have not tried to model for an impact of the of a change in minimum wage because that discrete change doesn't drive enough spending to be something that's material versus other factors that are driving large numbers of population change.
Yep, follow up. But historically, yes, but with the ACA, which has been there quite a while, you've got a significant number of the ACA people that are employed, but historically have not made, either haven't worked enough hours or haven't made enough money. And so that health care cliff benefit definitely comes into play. So it seems like that calculation would be important for OHA to look at.
Yeah, I understand the argument. I think we'll need to take a look at what results look like to be able to construct a model to be able to consider that.
Okay. Go ahead. Thank you.
I'm just going to let that go unresponded.
Yeah.
Okay.
You want to respond? Go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think that the minimum wage in Portland is like $11.50 an hour. That's the highest it is in the state, and that's if you're able to work 40 hours a week, that's $24,000 a year, and maybe that makes some adults ineligible, but like a lot of those folks are kids, and I think it's a little premature to be worrying about that. It's not going to be $15 an hour for at least four more years.
Okay. Let's go on.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. So moving on and actually finishing up on that last slide, all that meant to illustrate was there is a big change in terms of the number of people who are ultimately closed after the 90-day retroactive period. So we do want to look at the population again down the line. And the next slide is our current OHP forecast that came to us in the spring. Actually, the fall forecast is actually in the process of being worked on and should be published, I think, in early November, maybe late October. But what we do after each one of the forecasts come out is that we do track actuals and track the variation of the actuals compared to what had been forecasted and used to make decisions about our budget. And what this chart illustrates is the actuals that have occurred for the Oregon Health Plan through August of 2017. And I should note the last three data points of the last 3 months are preliminary numbers, again, waiting for retroactivity to occur. But the person who does the forecasting for us is able to make adjustments and mathematically calculate basically what the retro factor will be for each of the individuals. So he's feels pretty confident in the committee that's associated with this. With this forecast is pretty confident in the methodology that he uses. And what you can see in the forecast is that the actuals for a little bit in early 2017 through maybe roughly May or June or so were rising a little bit above, a few percentage points above what had been forecasted. The latest numbers show that the numbers had actually come down to line up again with the forecast. So at this point, we're not really anticipating any kind of overall impact of having to go back and work on these 115,000 folks over the course of the summer, and really feel that over the course of the biennium, the average number per month will more or less line up with what we had used to set the budget for this particular biennium.
If I could add one other important point, the fact that the redetermination was being done on the 115,000 people and a projected result of that redetermination was built into the 17-19 budget. So it's not that this work results in some kind of a bonus that wasn't taken into consideration. It was part of the development of the budget.
Yeah, and actually, just to add on to that a little bit further, because of the way the model works for a forecast, where the forecaster is essentially looking at predictions about the number of people entering Medicaid and the number of people leaving Medicaid, and also the transfer between various caseload buckets, so to speak, of Medicaid. He was fully aware of these 115,000 folks and of the process that was being used to address them, as he was as we went through the leveling process of 2016. So he was mathematically able to account for this in the forecast that he delivered to us.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just having a little bit of a hard time wrapping my head around this. So we had a presentation before, and we had forecasted 115,000 plus that were ineligible, that were in the system, that were going to affect the budget. Now we're back here, and we're saying that 115,000 aren't affecting. How does that happen?
Well, I can't.
And you're saying that that was accounted for? I don't.
Well, first, just to be clear, Chair Greenlick, Representative Hack, the 115,000 was the total pool to be redetermined, some number of whom were found no longer qualified for benefits, and that's the 20-odd thousand administratively and the 30,000 that we think will be a smaller number over time. So it's probably, well, I don't want to say probably, it's something less than the 50,000 combined that we have right now. My understanding, and I've had this repeated to me by LFO and by other agency staff and by members of Ways and Means, is that that activity going on was factored into the development of the 17-19 budget for the agency.
Can I have a follow-up?
Yes.
Thank you. So I guess for me, if we're talking even 50,000 people, and that's factored into a budget, and we have a difference of even 20,000 people, mm-hmm. that concerns me.
Certainly.
If we're basing our budgets on a percentage of 20,000 people or 50,000 people that may or may not be eligible or not, what are we telling our constituents and the people of the state of Oregon our budgets are really worth? If we're that far off and we're saying that that's okay,
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hack, I don't think I'm trying to say that, although plus or minus 20 or 30,000 out of a million, in terms, if you look at this forecast, we're pretty close to the forecast amount. Okay. And so, yes, it's a piece of work that we needed to get done, but it's not
if
possible
I may,
to
though,
say it drives a lot of variance in the spending.
If I may, that's one small fraction of your budget, though. So if this theory is used throughout your budget, and we're okay with being 50,000 off here, what are we okay with elsewhere, I guess, is my concern.
Yeah, Chair Greenlick, Representative Hack, what I would point to is the actuals to the forecast, and that when you add all of those pluses and minuses and the ordinary variation that occurs in a year, I think the record is that we're pretty close to our forecast.
Okay.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead. Please go for it.
Yeah, thanks. Pat, do you have any sense of how long these 55,000 people were enrolled in Medicaid? I mean, how many years were they eligible and they were receiving benefits but weren't eligible for benefits? And how much health services actually did they consume during those years? How much did it cost us?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller. Individuals are eligible for Medicaid until they're demonstrated to not be eligible. In other words, they have to go through a renewal process or a redetermination process before they're determined as ineligible. So, no, we cannot provide any information to you to describe a time that they may not have been, quote-unquote, eligible and the dollars associated with it.
But I think if I can expand on your question, can we determine anything about the 115,000 people, regardless of what their status was at any particular time, of how long they were on the system and what the expenditures were related to them? Is that closer to?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, for everybody who's on Medicaid, we can tell you how long they've been on Medicaid.
Could you tell me how long the 55,000 that have gone through the redetermination process were on Oregon Medicaid?
Certainly.
And can you tell me how much health services were consumed by them through those years?
Yes.
I'd be interested in seeing that.
Okay. Uh-huh.
We have that. The assumption that some proportion of that population weren't eligible prior to now. See if we can get some sense of that.
Yeah, I think to be clear, we can provide information about how long they were on Medicaid and the healthcare consumption. We would not be able to provide information or commentary on their eligibility status during that period of time, because they are eligible, as John says, until they are specifically determined not to be eligible.
And the federal government gave us authorization to leave them on until we
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So of that 115. 60,353 remain on the plan. 31,895 have no response. So we don't know that they're not eligible. We just know that we got no response from them. They might still be poor and still qualify for the Oregon Health Plan. And another 23,000 are in administrative review because we still have more work to do. They'll be in this 90-day process.
Other way around. The 22,000 have conclusively been determined to no longer
okay.
be qualified
for benefits.
So
they were poor at some point, and now they're not poor enough to be on the Oregon Health Plan.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. So just to clarify, based on your predecessor and their reports to us previously, they had forecasted for the 2017-19 budget that 26% of these 115,000 members would not be qualified. That's what they said, 26% won't be qualified for it. I believe that number, although it's still a little bit soft, came in at 46%. So you're saying the gap between the 26% and the 46%, or roughly $103 million, is insignificant to your budget. Is that what you're saying?
No, Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, if you look at the slide that I have up now and you see the 48% that are closed, which is the number you're referring to, that's okay. The gross initial determination. And your number would assume that all 31,000 of those stay closed and don't end up being retroactively qualified. Our belief actually is that a large portion of those will end up being found to be qualified and entitled to retroactive benefits. And if you look at the slide below, you can see over time how that ordinarily breaks out in terms of initial determination versus final.
So you're assuming that that will drop that 48% back to the 26%.
I believe what you're telling me is that's the assumption that was made in the presentation you heard earlier. Sure.
That's great.
Let's move on.
Okay.
Thank you. Chairman Greenlick and Vice Chair Knowles, and the members of the committee, for the record, I'm Wayne Haddad, Business Information Systems Director with OHA, and I'm here to talk about the process and the systems involved with this reconciliation. I won't take you through all the boxes on this slide, but on the left, suffice it to say, those are the five systems that we have been using to determine Medicaid eligibility. The two that are grayed out, the top and the bottom one, are being phased out now as a result of completing this reconciliation. So we'll have fewer systems that we maintain Medicaid eligibility in, which is a good benefit in terms of reducing complexity. Some of the benefits of that are, you know, that we're going to, the majority of our population is now in the one system, which many of you, I think, have heard about and are aware of. That's where most all the Medicaid membership eligibility is determined outside of the APD Medicaid members. It will also result in improved data quality. We're now verifying Social Security numbers against the Social Security Administration database, for instance. We're verifying income against federal and state databases, so it allows us to make more accurate and timely determinations on eligibility. And then we are also implementing some new controls to ensure that we maintain accurate eligibility going forward. So we're modifying our operational procedures, and we're developing new reports that can be monitored to ensure that we stay current on the eligibility status for all the Medicaid population.
Okay, that's a good question.
And the last slide I have today just talks about the process that we went through. We utilized our member services staff in the Oregon Health Authority to do the lion's share of this work, but not all of it. We also relied on other resources to help, SHAVS, Galt, PHTAC, and KPMG, to name the major contributors. We also, and we implemented the weekly dashboard that we provided to the governor's office and to CMS as we worked through this process from May through August to track our work completed, work to be accomplished. Those reports were produced and delivered. And we also engaged the community, the CCOs and our community partners to help us contact members. So where we needed to place some outgoing phone calls and things of that nature to ensure we were making every effort to reach these members, we did that, and we had a lot of support, again, from our CCOs and community partners. Their contributions were instrumental in getting this work accomplished.
Representative Bueller, do you have a comment?
Yeah, thank you. Just a question, Chair. How confident are you in the one system accuracy going forward in terms of determining eligibility?
Representative Greenlick, Representative Bueller, thank you, members of the committee. I'm highly confident. Putting a number on it is going to be difficult to do, I think, until we have some cycles that we go through to see how it turns out. We did have the Secretary of State come in and audit us in the spring of this year, and their findings were that our eligibility determinations on the one system were highly accurate, and I'm stretching for the number, but I think it was above 99%. I think it was 99.3% accurate, I believe. And so take that with a grain of salt, I guess. I'm not able to confirm it on the spot here. Maybe I shouldn't have stated it. But they came back with a finding that said we were maintaining very accurate membership. And that's probably the best barometer I have at this time. Okay, and my last comment to the committee is that this also gave us an opportunity to work very closely with DHS and coordinate the handling of our aged and disabled members on Medicaid. So the little extra due process was involved there, and we worked and collaborated very closely between agencies to accomplish that.
My question is the process now going forward month by month? How is it doing as it's moving forward?
Chair Greenlick, the process going forward, what does that look like? Is that...
Well, what you said is once you get to 115,000 determined, then the ongoing process will evaluate eligibility. I was wondering, I assume that started, and my question is, how is it going?
Well, we are in the first month of monitoring that the process, and so we're to the 20th of September, so we haven't completed a full month cycle yet. My comment was more as over time, as the months pass, every member or every Medicaid member receives, we have to redetermine them on an annual basis. So through the course of time, each month we'll redetermine a portion of that membership, and we'll be able to see then if there are significant swings.
Well, I was asking how the system is going, and the answer is it's just started. So we'll
yes,
know.
Sir.
Too soon.
It would be really interesting for us to I would say in November, how it's actually, what it's actually producing.
But I think it is relevant that if you look at the this lower graph here, this relates to that point, right? In terms of lower numbers of initial initial determinations and yet lower numbers of final determinations, where the system itself is able to generate better data and do a better job of that.
Good. Representative Buhlen.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlee. Does the one system auto enroll people for the first time? I mean, not redetermination, but automatically enroll people in Medicaid?
Chairman Greenlick and Representative Buhler, members of the committee, the one system has many ways for us to accept data. So we can bring, the members can do it over the web, they can send us faxed forms, they can email us, they can call us. So there's a variety of ways for us to receive their data and consider their application. The application consideration and eligibility determination process do require a human within the state, somebody in our member services department, to process that application. So there's no system automated determinations that don't involve some level of human involvement.
And of course, that member services function has now shifted over to Department of Human Services, and we're in the midst of that transfer.
Right. I have a constituent whose 20-year-olds were automatically enrolled into Medicaid. They've never been on Medicaid. Always been on his private insurance, never been on any state services. Both of them were auto-enrolled. One lives in Texas. Haven't been able to get an answer of why they were auto-enrolled in Medicaid from your predecessors.
Be happy to follow up and see if we can get an answer to that quickly.
That'd be great.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Thank you, Chair. So I like, as far as your process, the partnership you've developed with CCOs and making sure that they help contact members. Now, we know that CCOs can't redetermine for our members, right? But members have to call the state office to be able to be redetermined, right? Is that correct? I'm trying to make sure I'm following the process. So I've had some experience with some folks in my community say, I've been calling the state to simply change my address, and it's taken me 2 months. So I guess I'm trying to understand how the CCOs play. They're calling all of their members to make sure that they call the Oregon Health Department to make sure that they are redetermined. There's a flow of people trying to get redetermined at the same time. That's still an issue. Can you guys help me understand how we're mitigating that process, that problem?
Yeah, I can speak to that just a little bit. And I'll cop to the 2.5 weeks into the job excuse as long as I can. But I have been privy to a dashboard that's been used internally to monitor that activity, call wait times and processing and those kinds of things in there. There has been, through the critical peak of this work, there have been times where it's been a challenge to be able to get through to the center. My understanding is that has now largely, although not entirely, resolved, and monitoring that becomes a part of the work that we do with DHS going forward to make sure that the eligibility determination process is working the way that it should.
So we're hoping, follow-up, Chair, I'm sorry. We're hoping that those challenges that people are having in redetermining and waiting forever for this process to happen, do you have an end date, approximate date in which you feel that most people have been attended to and have been redetermined?
Well, at this point, the only people who would be not through this process would be the 30,000 or so non-responders who may be amongst the constituents that you were talking about trying to reach us. The dashboards that I've seen show that bulk of calls problems has worked its way through the system. So I'd be curious to know if you've got constituents who are trying to get in now who continue to have a problem, and we can try to address that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hack, let's take your question and then let's move to the next topic.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine is a little on the same, and I don't know, Pat, if I missed kind of the transition in leadership, so I apologize if I did, but I think for me, I want to know a little bit about what your plan is as far as the enrollment piece. I know you're only 2.5 weeks in, and welcome. Thank you for step it up and taking that.
Get rid of it.
But we continue to have issues with the enrollment side, and we've talked about, you know, meeting people where they are and how we get to people and, you know, giving access to folks, especially our poor folks who may not have access to computers and different things, and how we do this and how we make it easier for people to, once they are enrolled, mm-hmm. how do we keep them enrolled when they are eligible so we don't have the problems that we're talking about with these folks that are and then they aren't. And anyway, and I get that DHS now is going to play a role in that, but my fear is I don't want to have another situation like we have in so many of our committees where we hear that they're doing it and we're not. And I'm not saying that you're passing the buck. I don't want to imply that. But I just want to know, what is your plan as far as taking this issue on, and how are you going to work with DHS, and what are we going to hear? Are we going to hear 6 months from now that we have this resolved? Are we going to hear a year from now? Where are we at?
Yeah, so
people need health care, sure. And this continues to be an issue.
Sure, Chair Greenlake, Representative Hack. I can't tell you yet in detail in answer to your question, but I can tell you the way that I'm going to approach this, which is I'm not a bystander to this process. OHA continues to own this process every bit as much as DHS does. And so my perspective on this will be that it's my job to work with Fair Morris Baxter Ashton and our staff to work with his staff together to make sure that we're doing what we need to do to effectively deliver services to deal with the needs of these Oregonians. I should be able to come back to you in November legislative days and talk more intelligently about the details that you're asking about. But from a philosophical standpoint, this is not something that I want to wash my hands of and you know, point to some other floor on the Human Services building and say it's their problem. It will continue to be something that I own every bit as much as DHS does.
Chair, would it be appropriate to have Fairbors and Pat come back maybe in November in legislative days and give us a report? I love Fairbors.
It would be appropriate. It would be necessary.
Advocate, so that would be great if we could have that opportunity.
And he'll be excited to hear that I volunteered him.
We'll need to bring a sidekick with him. If you go to that other floor, get here.
Okay, I think then if we're done with this issue, I'd like to, we're going to do a little bit of a change up for OHA staff and actually call up Laura Robinson and Chelsea Guest to talk about the rate setting process in the interest of making sure that we get that topic dealt with in the hour that you have given us. And see if I can get the right presentation.
You have a question while we're changing.
Yeah, I had a quick question, if I could.
Yep.
Okay, very, very quickly. My, this would probably be to Patrick Allen, and I know you've only been there a couple of weeks, and between the application and what was approved by CMS on January 12, 2017, for the 1115A waiver, within that document you'll find the technical reading that CMS did approve for CCOs to self-enroll their own clients when Oregon had the technology to do it. We asked for that in the application. CMS approved that in the application. Maybe it's not on your radar yet, but I think that would be extremely helpful to Oregonians that need Medicaid to allow their own CCOs to enroll them through your system. And my technical reading of that document allows that to happen.
It's absolutely on my radar, Representative.
Okay.
So with that, I'm going to step away and turn the presentation to Laura Robinson, who is the Chief Financial Officer of the Health Authority, and Chelsea Guest, who is our Chief Actuary.
Thank you, Pat. Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose, Vice Chair Hayden, members of the committee, for the record, my name is... Yes.
Pat, there may be some just general questions at the end if we have a few minutes to talk about other things. So if you hang around, you can't sneak out.
Almost nice made a clean getaway.
I'm sorry, Laura.
No problem. So I'll just start at the top. So Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose, Vice Chair Hayden, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Robison. I'm the CFO for the Oregon Health Authority. And so, you know, no, you're not dreaming. I did have a different name and a different job the last time you saw me. But like Pat, I've been with the Health Authority for just over 2 weeks and really had a great opportunity to work with some really talented staff. You'll hear from Chelsea in a moment as we talk to you a little bit about our rate methodology and our rate process. So we wanted to come here today to talk to you a little bit about where we've been and where we are for the 2018 process. I did want to point out, I think many of you are probably very familiar with this process or familiar with parts of it. But OHA does contract with a third-party consulting actuary who does submit the actuarial certification on behalf of the state to CMS. He's not here with us today. Chelsea and I are going to really talk through in a more, I'd say, a more general level about what our methodology has been, what it is currently, and also what our process in terms of engaging with our stakeholders has been for 2018 and kind of where, you know, what are our next steps with respect to that process. So I'm just kind of running through the agenda, which, sorry, would you go? Thank you. So I just wanted to set up a little bit about how I how we'll structure our presentation, and please, of course, ask us questions along the way. We'll start by talking a little bit about just core principles that guide our work and the work of our actuary in developing the rates, talk about the history, and then really get into where we are with our current process. So thank you, Pat.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Before you go too much further, is the third party that you refer to, is that Optimist?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hack, yes, that's correct. Optimist is the consulting actuarial firm.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us a little bit about Optimist before you get too much farther and why Optimist was chosen?
Why is there what?
Why Optimist? And a little bit about them before they get too much farther.
Sure. Chair Greenlake, Representative Hack, I'll start, and then I am going to ask Chelsea Guest to provide a little bit more historical information. But Optimus is an actuarial consulting firm, and they have extensive expertise in Medicaid rate development and capitated rate development. And they were brought on by the Oregon Health Authority in 2015, I believe, to there was a shift in our rate methodology, and so they were brought on at that time. And I'll ask Chelsea to provide a little bit more about the context of why Optimus was chosen as the consulting firm. And sorry, actually, one thing I will note, too, is I just want to be thoughtful that, you know, we're kind of nearing the end of the current engagement with Optimus and are about to embark on an RFP. So I just want to be thoughtful that we're talking about kind of the current work with Optimus.
And just to clarify, so Chair Greenlick, Representative Hack, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chelsea Guest, and I'm the manager of the Actuarial Services Unit. I'm not an actuary. Optimus was contracted with OHA, I believe, in 2012 or 2013 for consulting. At that time, we were certifying the rates internally. In 2015, and I'll get into some of this history later on in the presentation, when we moved to an external contract certification, we were already contracting with them, and we asked them to certify our rates externally, not internally, which is what we previously had been doing. They provided more consulting services before 2015 in terms of actuarial opinions and thoughts, and then in 2015, they began certifying our rates. And we're at the end of that five-year contract at the end of this year, and that's where Laura mentioned we're up for RFP for that contract going forward.
Can I have a follow-up? Good. And you'll be looking at others during the RFP process. I guess my question would be to dig a little deeper. Have you felt that they are a clear third party with a non-biased rate-setting opinion?
I believe we have to stay neutral since we're about to enter into the procurement. Representative or Chair Greenlake,
yeah,
and Representative
Hack.
Where
this is going? But.
Yeah,
I just want a clarification on that.
Yeah, do you want to?
Sure, Chair Greenlake, Representative Hack. I think Chelsea's absolutely right that as we're, you know, coming to the end of our contract and just about to go out for a competitive RFP, I think, you know, we really, you know, it wouldn't be appropriate for us to comment on kind of the quality of the work at this point. But to your point, it will be a competitive open RFP.
And the reason I'm asking that is simply because we've had some issues with the rate setting and some concern about rate setting with some of our CCOs. So I just want to make sure that whoever we do have, that we're making sure that they have a very
I've had some issues with them too, but
non-bias.
Simply because I thought
we're
diligent wrong.
In finding non-biased right. folks to set them.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. And
step
we,
away for a moment. It's nothing you said.
Nothing personal. Okay, I won't take it personally. thank you. And so, yes, we will be keeping you updated, too, as that process proceeds. So I did want to start our conversation with just more of a, you know, I'd say laying the groundwork for how we and our actuarial consultant approaches the rate development work. And there are a couple of key principles that really form the foundation of the rate methodology. The first of these is actuarial soundness. And in a nutshell, what actuarial soundness means, and there are some, you know, more technical definitions of this, but it basically means that the rates are making a reasonable provision for all of the reasonable and appropriate costs to provide the services. So you might have heard you know, me or others talk about actuarial soundness in the commercial sense, that basically rates are not too high, they're not too low, they're making kind of a reasonable estimate for future costs, and that applies here as well.
I have an issue with that as we go forward, and the question is whether the whole methodology is actuarially sound, whether it produces rates, 16 different rates that each are actuarially sound. I think it's the former that should apply in this situation.
Chair Greenlick, I am going to talk a little bit about that, but you're...
I'll leave if you but
maybe if I could just do the quick answer to your question is, yes, actuarial soundness in the Medicaid, managed care, capitated rate setting process means that it's sound across the entire program and not sound down to the individual CCO level.
Keep remembering that.
We do, and I know that's kind of an issue, that's a question that comes up a lot. And it's also quite a bit different if I'm looking at everything through the lens of, you know, I'm used to the commercial health insurance market, and so trying to think about, well, how is this similar or different? And so that, I think that's a really important point to point out, is when you've heard DCBS in particular talk about the rate review process for commercial rates, that is a different process, a different standard, and that's where individual health insurers are submitting to the state their projection, basically for approval by the state. This is a process where we as OHA actually have to make the certification and the application to the federal government for the rates for the Medicaid program as a whole to be approved. And so the way that the actuarial standards and federal laws and rules are constructed, it really is focused on that program level, so really across all of the CCOs, making sure that the rates are sound.
And if I could just comment for the record, I know that this is a significant point of disagreement out there between us and at least one CCO, and for my part, that's a key answer I need to get to my own independent understanding of to make sure we can move forward on rates. But I'm not there yet.
So just to continue with a couple more just foundational elements. So I mentioned that actuarial soundness is a kind of a bedrock of the rate methodology process, but there are also a number of professional standards that actuaries are obligated to follow in conducting their work. And they also are bound, we are bound as OHA to follow federal statutes and regulations and guidance that CMS issues about how they expect Medicaid capitated rates to be developed. So at the end of the day, when we submit our rate certification, it needs to comply with all of those standards. And then, you know, the final piece is, you know, not at all unimportant, but we this is a program that is funded by public funds, and so we have budget constraints, and we need to be, you know, we have to budget as an agency, and you have to approve that budget to ensure that we can pay those rates to cover the costs for members on the Oregon Health Plan. Did you want to add something to that? Oh, okay. So from here, I will turn it back over to Chelsea Guest to talk a little bit about the history of our rate methodology.
Again, just for the record, my name is Chelsea Guest, and I'm the manager of the Actuarial Services Unit for OHA. First off, I'm going to go through some history, hopefully at a high level, and the changes in our methodology that have happened over the last few years. So the first methodology that I have on the slide, it took us from really the 90s up till September 2011. This was based on a statewide base rate and was adjusted for regional and plan-specific factors. Thank you. The process was commonly called the per capita cost, and was certified by an external actuarial consultant for the majority of those years, and moved to in-house actuaries in mid-2009. Then in 2011, we had a budget shortfall, and then subsequently we submitted an 1115 waiver that dictated specific reductions in growth for the Oregon Medicaid program. At that point, OHA's actuaries developed a rate process that gave plans the flexibility to build their own rates through a template in order to meet an aggregate rate of growth reduction or target increase based on whether it was the 2011 reduction of about 10%, and then subsequently the 1115 waiver had targeted increases. While this met the need at the time, our federal partner CMS expressed concerns over this methodology in 2014 and again in 2015 after the ACA expansion occurred. And CMS's investment increased significantly. As you remember, they were putting the complete bill in 2014, and then it started dropping down later on. For CMS, the ACA pressure caused them to involve the Office of the Actuary that was normally on the Medicare side, but they started to review our rates on the Medicaid side in 2015. Before the review was more cursory and much more simple at the regional level and by policy staff.
Excuse me. There was also a complaint from the CCOs in 2015 as well.
I
think that's important to remember. They complained as well, so that's part of how we got here.
Yeah.
This is very interesting for me because I was new to all this.
And so I'll get to the CCO. So actually, my next point. So for Oregon, in addition to the CMS concerns with OHA's specific process, which led and the CCOs issued a letter in early 2015 expressing significant concerns with the rate methodology. So both the CMS concerns and questions that we received along with CCO concerns led leadership to move to a new methodology and certification with an external actuarial consultant. Because remember, it was internal for us, that 2009, still with the per capita cost, but 2011 to 14, it was still certified internally by OHA actuaries.
That's when we hired Optimus to do it.
And that's when Optimus started certifying our rates, to your point, Representative Nose, 2015 through our rates that we currently proposed of 2018. Do you want to? Okay. And that gets us to our current rate methodology. Actually, you could go back one slide at the very bottom. That is regional experience with risk factors. One risk factor is our disease risk factor that assesses the population risk differences between CCOs and also hospital reimbursement differences based on the regional, which is our critical access hospitals have a higher reimbursement than our urban hospitals that are on DRG reimbursement.
And Chelsea, if I could just add one thing too. One of the things you might find kind of interesting, if you look at the methodology that was in place back before 2011, where we had this statewide rate development and there was variation or factors to vary by region and by risk, and then you look at the methodology that we have today, they're different in the sense that the older methodology really started with statewide data and then made adjustments at the end of the process to consider differences in cost by region and differences in risk by CCO. What's the nuance that's different with the current methodology is that the data that is used to develop the rates is actually done at a regional level. So they're not what we're not doing is not taking statewide data and adjusting it. We're starting with regional data to develop the rate for that region. And then if we have multiple CCOs in a region, the adjustment for each CCO is based on the relative risk of the population that that CCO is serving in that region. So there's some similarities, but there are a little bit of a little nuance in the difference. And it is, as Chelsea mentioned, it's really important that the regional differences be reflected, both because of the real differences in cost, and also that is something that is in line with the actuarial standards of practice and how rates are developed.
Okay.
Keep going.
Okay, so results.
Representative Bueller.
Yeah. Thank you, Acting Chair Nose. In the rate setting methodology, do you have a standard forecast of what you'd expect CCOs to spend on impacting the social determinants of health?
Chair or acting chair, yeah. Representative Jones, and
just chair.
Don't give him too much power.
Okay. In terms of, I think what we're calling them health-related services, or services that are, what we're coined flexible services, is that correct?
I'm not sure.
Okay. In terms of innovation, we don't actually dictate how CCOs spend their money or their individual business models. If they do report any of those costs in our rate setting process, it does have to be accounted for in the non-medical load or the admin component of the rate development. But we don't have a target of what they should or should not spend.
If I may interject, yeah. Since I'm the acting chair, I believe the way that rates are set is it's based on a category of type of person who receives the benefit,
right.
And then there's a rate that's established based on whether they're a dual eligible or a pregnant mom,
correct.
Or an adult in the expansion, and then the money is doled out that way. It's not done based on services or your business model. It's based on just how many people you have who are eligible at a certain way for the Oregon Health Plan. Is that correct?
Vice Chair Nose, I think just to clarify a little bit, so you're absolutely correct that the rates are developed actually based on, we call them cohorts or rate cells, but basically based on the population that there are differences in the populations that we're serving and the reasons for eligibility, and that's per CMS regulation. But I think to Representative Bueller's question about how we're recognizing basically non-medical spending that's meant to address, you know, basically social determinants of health, and we do call, you know, we have a technical term for it in how the financials are reported to us. But I think Chelsea's point was that information is captured in our rate setting process, but it's not considered a medical expense in the rate. But that is captured in the administrative cost load. And so we're not necessarily dictating how much should be spent, but we're not necessarily penalizing or rewarding companies or CCOs for spending a certain amount or for not spending a certain amount.
Sure. Could you split out of the administrative bucket how much is being spent on social determinants for each CCO? Mm-hmm. Is that being reported?
Chelsea, yeah. Do you want to take that one, actually?
Vice Chair Nose and Representative Bueller, we can give you a percentage in over our regions of the load that we include in the rates. Is that helpful?
I don't know.
By CCO.
Those could do it.
Yeah.
We might be able to get to that detail.
Yeah, I'd ask if we could go back and you know, as I'm learning kind of what data we have, I'd like to go back and see if we can provide that to you. So could we follow up with you with that?
Just so I'm clear what I'm looking for. So I'd like to know for each CCO the amount of revenue they're spending on social determinants, both as a gross number and a percentage.
A percentage of their total. Okay. So we will look at that. I think we should be able to get you something. And so just
sure.
bear
sure.
with
no,
you
no,
and go
no
back
hurry.
And look
yeah.
at what data we have. But we will follow up.
Okay.
All right. So, Chelsea, okay. You want to go back and
yes.
continue on?
Okay. Right. So slide 5. Go back one. There you go. So in the previous slide, I mentioned the regional methodology with the plan-specific risk adjustment. Some of the results that we've had related to the current methodology that's been since 2015, we've continued to achieve the program-wide global budget targets set forth in both the waiver and built into our budget. Operating margin is more consistent across the program due to the actuarial sound principles and matching payment to risk. We have continued transparency in the rate development process. CCOs have the opportunity to collaborate with us really starting almost February of this year for the 2018 process in multiple touch points where they can provide feedback.
If I could just comment briefly on that, we know this is an area that's a sensitive spot as well with some CCOs. And what I would say is we certainly have improved the transparency of the system, and what we're committed to doing is to continue to find ways to further improve that transparency. Transparency.
Okay, let's keep going.
Yeah. And then just lastly, we have received approval from our federal partners for 2015 through 2017, and we anticipate also for 2018 to receive approval since the methodology is mostly the same. Okay, so I guess I've covered the first point. So methodology has been consistent since 2015. And I wanted to highlight a few key topics that have happened in the 2018 rates that may be of interest since 2017. So for 2018 rates, we have observed an impact based on the redeterminations that have gone through the one system, which was just presented on. We have assessed those redeterminations in the rate process through May 2017, and it has put an upward pressure on the per-member rate because the members we've seen that have dropped off have had lower utilization and lower costs. So as they drop off, the per-member rate does increase a little bit. So we have adjusted the rates to account for that, and CCOs have done their own analysis and provided that to us, and we've collaborated over that process. Secondly, we still have upward pressure from pharmacy costs. This continues to be a problem. It's a little less than it was last year, but we still are seeing high trends in this area. Costs for rural and critical access hospitals are continuing to increase and putting upward pressure on our rates, and this is affecting some of our rural CCOs that have to contract with these hospitals. We also had some policy changes. Specifically, we expanded hepatitis C coverage, which is the direct-acting antiviral medications, to stage two starting January 1st, and that was negotiated in the legislative budget. And then we anticipate, or we're estimating, that 2018 rates, based on where we're forecasting, will meet the legislatively mandated general fund growth target. And I'll turn it back to Laura to talk about our timeline and next steps.
Great. Thank you, Chelsea. So I'll try to run quickly through these next two slides. So we've talked about methodology. Now we'll talk a little bit about our process. So this process actually began much earlier this year, back in February, and it is still ongoing right now. And it's a collaborative process where we and our actuarial consultant and CCOs are in pretty continuous communication, sharing information, having discussions. We've met in person individually and on a group basis with a number of CCOs, and you know, to Pat's point, you know, there's, I think, been great strides made in the to improve transparency and collaboration in this process, and we plan to continue looking for ways to do that, and I'll talk more about that when we wrap up. But we've been going through this process of sharing draft information, sharing our analysis, asking for clarification, for feedback about whether we're getting it right, whether there are issues that we're not considering or that there's disagreement, and we've been ironing those out along the way. We provided draft rates to CCOs in mid-August, and we had an opportunity for the CCOs to review those, provide us with any concerns or feedback, and those were given to us at the end of August. And we had originally planned to give final rates to the CCOs on September 1st, but September 1st was we had a rather significant leadership transition, and so Pat and I decided that it would be a good opportunity for us to work with Chelsea and Optimus and really gain a better understanding of the rates and the methodology and the process. And so we did decide to delay that release probably by a week. So we did provide those final rates on the 8th, and I think we also shared with you all kind of an update of where we were on that at that time. I say they're final, but we will have final rates shortly. And the reason that these aren't completely final is because we do allow one more opportunity for CCOs to provide us with any concerns or feedback. And so that process is ongoing right now. We've asked for that feedback to be provided to us by this Friday. And then in the next 2 weeks, we are going to be reviewing that feedback, meeting with CCOs to respond to that feedback, whether that be to, you know, communicate how we plan to address those concerns, to ask clarifying questions, or to be able, if we disagree, to articulate that and why. So that's what the next 2 weeks looks like. And then the week of October 2nd, we plan to submit the rate certification to CMS. So I've covered the first two bullets here. I wanted to kind of end on two really important points. Since we've spent a little time today talking about redeterminations, Chelsea mentioned that the final rates that have been sent to the CCOs on the 8th, that they have right now, do include the impact of the redeterminations that had been done through May. And as we've discussed, a lot of work was done since May, and we still don't have a final, basically a final determination for some of the people that were still waiting for that 90-day period to run. So we already do plan between now and the end of the year, once that 90-day period is run, to evaluate what the true impact of those redeterminations is on the rates, and we may need to adjust the rates based on that information. You know, the preliminary information that we have through May, as Chelsea said, indicates that the people who were deemed no longer eligible were people who were using less medical services. And so You know, on average, that means that the rates go up if you take less costly people out of the system. And so that's something that we need to be really attuned to when we and making sure that these rates are as accurate as possible. So that is something that we're going to be looking at. And it is possible that there could be other emerging issues we need to consider. You know, we don't take that lightly because it's a pretty lengthy and challenging process. And also our CCOs need time to operationalize these rates and get prepared for 2018. So we really want to be mindful of getting this ironed out as quickly as possible. And so that's kind of what's ahead in terms of the process for this year. And then we will be doing a debrief internally with our team and then also with all of the CCOs to really go through what worked well, what didn't work well, what improvements can be made, and really work toward a clear plan for the 2019 process. And we will gladly come back to report to you about what that process will look like. And so that's the end of our prepared remarks, but we're happy to answer any questions that you have.
Before I take questions, there's two things that we didn't get to yet. Are you going to talk about the contracting update for 2018, or is that... And then we didn't get Kim Fredlund from the director's office in DHS up. She's going to give a quick update, too, and I want to let her do that.
Yeah, so, Mr. Chair, it's really up to you. We've gone over the time you allotted, and I want to be sensitive to the remainder of your agenda. We would be happy to come back in November.
I do want to get Kim up, so maybe we could do the discussion about CCO contracting for 2018 during November. If there's quick questions, I'll go ahead and take them. So I see Representative Kenemer.
Yes, I guess I really didn't see us covering the leadership transition, which was the first issue.
You missed it.
Yeah, I must have missed it. It was pretty short, if it was there. And congratulations, and I appreciate, you know, we sent you to DCBS some time ago, and I think your record there was admirable, and this is an agency in distress, in my view. And I guess I have some real concerns about, fortunately, we have some records about the treatment of family care, perhaps others as well. And I just kind of wanting to know how that transition and how many others are involved in that. With three leaving, it's a pretty strong signal. And you know, and I guess another aside that makes it much more complicated is I go back a long time with this agency, and we seem to have what we diagnose as repetition compulsion. We keep making the same mistakes over and over and over, and it's a huge challenge. And I think there are some very dedicated people. We've been a national leader in innovation. We want to be sure we salvage the good, but we also want to quit repeating the
sins. Representative Kenemer, was there a question in there?
I'm asking for some reassurance on what we're going to do about this.
All right. And why don't you go ahead and take
certainly.
A few minutes
Chair,
to do that.
Chair, no, Representative Kenemer, regarding the communications plan, I'll say what I said before the Senate General Government Committee yesterday, which is that in my review of the record, I'm satisfied that plan, the development and direction for it were driven by Lynn Saxton and Beth Ann Darby, and that there weren't other staff people who were involved in causing it to be created and guiding its creation. There were certainly other staff people who were swept up in that work as a matter of course. But I think with the departure of those two individuals, the issue that underlay the problem with family care, I believe, is addressed. And certainly, you and I have known each other a long time, and you know that sort of thing is completely inconsistent with the way that that I approach my job. And I think most of you are familiar with the staff we've begun to bring into the agency, and know that it's similarly inconsistent with those folks, and that what we're really trying to do is establish a strong agency culture of transparency, accountability, and wise use of public resources. There are a lot of things in running an agency where you have to really work bottom up to implement good work. Culture starts top down. I and the team that we're bringing in are committed to establishing that kind of a culture at the agency.
Super. I think Representative Buehler wanted to follow up.
Well, I'm going to, unfortunately, move the agenda along because we're running late. I'd like to get Kim up.
Thank you.
Do
you want me to stay here? Chair Greenlick.
Is there going to be a chance afterwards to get back? I think there's still some questions remaining that are legitimate. I'm not eager to beat people up. I'm eager to make sure we're on track.
Yeah. We have a lot to cover. Is there some specific things you want to ask, Pat? And I have one specific thing I'd like to have you cover sometime before we're done or we're almost done. I hear there's some talk about holding off the CCO 2.2 by extending the current contracts for a year.
Yeah, I can speak very briefly to that, Chair Greenlink, members of the committee. The question is whether to move forward right now on schedule with the next round of five-year contracts for coordinated care organizations, juxtaposed with the need to move forward with what's colloquially called CCO 2.0, which is really the next generation of innovation and evolution of the system. What I'm still in the process of trying to determine is if we move forward now, will we be able to deliver CCO 2.0 in those contracts, or will we be delivering CCO 1.1? Versus if we were to perhaps extend those contracts for a year and give ourselves time to do better groundwork than the agency has been able to focus on in the last while, would we be able to deliver, if not CCO 2.0, if I can completely torture the software metaphor, CCO 1.6 or 8. It's that balancing of the value of moving forward quickly versus getting as much innovation as we can. As an example, Representative Bueller talked about social determinants of health. I would be hard-pressed to be able, from the things that I have access to in the agency right now, show you what an intelligible contract provision trying to promote better development of social determinants of health would look like. And so if we contracted now, that might be something that we don't
I'd be glad to help you
address.
With that. I'd be glad to help you with that.
Well, no, I think I think it's not unknowable. I think that the agency hasn't done the groundwork to be prepared right now to move to contracts with that. And so interacting with you and others about what those kinds of things would need to look like is exactly what we would use that extended period of time for, so that we're able to do that intelligently.
I want to take this opportunity to put on the record that I strongly believe you should put it off for a year. And I think it's some work that we need to put into the process that the Health Policy Board will be talking to Zeke about needs to put into the process. And I would urge you to think about holding off for a year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Shall we proceed?
Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kim Fredland, and I'm the director of the self-sufficiency programs with the Department of Human Services. I know that we're running short on time, and so I'm going to try to speak as quickly as I can, and I think I can answer a lot of the questions that you had earlier about the eligibility processes as I go through these slides. So just really quickly, we're here to talk about the transition of the eligibility operations to DHS. And so really what that looks like is that that OHA will continue to be the single state Medicaid agency. They are responsible for the policy interpretation, the implementation, and the quality oversight. They're responsible for all of the CCO engagement. Really, our responsibility in DHS is operating that medical eligibility work. So we took a two-phased approach to this transition. The first phase was really about the management of the eligibility operations transitioned on September 1st. And so we've really been working between DHS and OHA on the operating agreements about how we're going to do that work together and what those agreements are. We have now started into the process of really working out the budget and the positions and all of those really technical pieces that will need to get approval in the February session to officially move this work into DHS. So the thing that I wanted to spend probably the most time is really talking about what our goals in from the DHS side are. This work of the eligibility call center is really a core part of the business that we do in the self-sufficiency programs. We administer SNAP, TANF, and child care to over 1 million Oregonians. At last count, there was about a 65% crossover of the population in the Medicaid population with the population that we serve. And we have been a national leader for the last 11 years, award-winning in our ability to deliver these services timely to families. We have goals about delivering services as much as possible on the same day or the next day that someone applies. We have goals when they walk into our office that we see them within 30 minutes wherever possible. And we will bring these same goals to the work of the eligibility of Medicaid services. So we have been, we were able, as we began this transition, we had a team of what we call lean leaders out in the call center mapping out all of the eligibility processes, because we wanted to start on day one really with a plan of what we needed to do to improve things like call times, because we want to be able to be much more responsive and not have people wait on the phone. They don't need to call us to redetermine their services. We want to make sure that that option is available either through the phone, online, in person, if they walk into one of our offices. As we improve on the timeliness, our first goal is to ensure that 100% of the applications are processed within the federal timelines, which is 45 days. And our true goal is really to get this work to as much as possible same day, next day, which is what we do all of our services through. We currently have a success rate of between 40 and 50% on an ongoing basis. Get those services same day, next day. Representative Hack, we believe that that'll probably take us 12 to 18 months to get to that point based on the analysis that we've done so far. And I'm going to turn it over to Wayne for your other comments.
Thank you, Kim, and I'll be quick. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Wayne Haddad, Business Information Systems Director for OHA. And I just have two quick slides I want to talk about. The first is the one system technology. To be clear, we are not making any immediate technology changes, although there will be changes as the integrated eligibility upgrades are incorporated into the one system. In the interim, there will also be some changes in upgrades in the one system. We've got a schedule of several enhancements that will be beneficial to the Oregonians that receive service and our ability to process that that information in a timely fashion. Next slide, just really to talk about communication. OHA and DHS will work in partnership with our CCOs. OHA will be the primary manager of communication. We'll schedule the meetings with the leadership of the CCOs. We'll determine policies, work with them in any changes, rates that were talked about earlier, other activities like that. And DHS will attend those meetings, and will also work directly with the members and helping them enroll in the right CCO, the one of their choice, and address things like whatever individual issues or concerns may be raised, because they'll have the frontline staff that's working with the Medicaid applicant or member. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Pat. We're happy you're where you are.
We'd be happy to answer any other questions you've got on this.
I think we need to move on.
Okay.
We'll bug you personally. And now we'll find out what you did leaving your crew at DCBS, whether they could survive your departure. We have the DCBS team. You want to say anything bad about Pat, you need to wait till he leaves the room.
Well, we'd say it to his face. So, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jean Strait, and I'm the Acting Director of the Department of Consumer Business Services. So we're here today to talk a little bit about some of our leadership changes, give you an update on the 1332 waiver application, 2018 rate review, and the COFA Oral Health Care Program. So I have with me today Rick Blackwell, our policy manager for the Division of Financial Regulation, and Chicky Flowers, our administrator for the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace, and they're going to help me with any questions you might have for me. So I'll start with the leadership transitions, and Chickie is one of those leadership transitions. Barry Leslie went over to the governor's office, and Chickie stepped up and was our acting administrator during session, and then she was our successful candidate through our recruitment process and started officially on September 1.
Congratulations.
Other changes that we're working through is Laura Robison moved over to the Oregon Health Authority, so we are without a Division of Financial Regulation Administrator and Insurance Commissioner right now. So we have started a recruitment on that. It will close on October 6th. We're putting together a pretty extensive recruitment process to include a lot of participation with stakeholders and staff, and so we're hoping that we will have that position, have an offer out mid-December, and probably have someone permanently on in January. Until then, we have two...
They're ambitious.
We're doing a pretty extensive outreach process right at the moment. So that's the goal. Whether we make it or not, I'm not sure. In the meantime, we have two deputies in the division, and they will be splitting... responsibilities. TK Keene will be responsible for advocacy and education, product regulation and policy, compliance and enforcement. And John Paul Jones will be handling administration, licensing, banking, credit unions, and financial institutions. And the insurance commissioner role will stay with the director. So that's our transition update for you. 1332 waiver. So the House Bill 2391 directed DCBS to apply for to CMS for a Section 1332 state innovation waiver. The Section 1332 of the Affordable Care Act permits us to diverge from or waive some of the ACA provisions. The 1332 waiver can't undermine the comprehensive benefits, affordability programs, or consumer protections of the ACA. Oregon's application asks that the single risk pool requirement of the ACA apply only to the extent necessary to implement a state reinsurance program. So if this is approved, Oregon's reinsurance program will reimburse individual health insurers for a portion of the cost of the high-cost enrollee claims. By operating this program, we expect to help stabilize the individual market and leading to lower individual market premiums. As required by the process, DCBS gave public notice of the application and allowed the opportunity for input. We had a comment period open from July 25th to August 25th, and we held public meetings on August 24th and 25th. We also did consultations with the Oregon tribes for their input. Our application was submitted on August 31st, and we have actually already received notification from CMS that our application was complete and that we received that on September 11th. So what that does is that starts the federal process. Their comment period is open until October 11th, and the whole process for them is 180-day federal processing. Assuming the waiver is approved, DCBS will establish a reinsurance program through the administrative rule process, including defining the details important to many of our stakeholders, such as the coinsurance rate, reinsurance cap, and the payment processes. So House Bill 2391 created the reinsurance program in state law pending the federal waiver approval and then the collection of assessments to fund the program.
Yeah, a quick question. This seems well and good. Is there anybody that's opposed to this? Is there any reason why someone would say we shouldn't do this, just so I can understand it?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Nose, I think that there is a bill out there that there is disagreement with how it's funded.
So it's the funding.
Okay.
It's called ACA.
I don't think, yeah.
Okay.
I think we don't want to talk about that right now.
No.
That's your initiative? Okay.
Okay. Any other questions about that? No? Okay, so to talk about the 2018 health insurance marketplace plans, the individual market, we approved rates for 7 companies, and those rates changes were from 1.6% decrease to a 14.8% increase. Some of the reasons for the rate changes were the cost of providing care exceeds the premiums collected by many carriers. There's a federal weakening of the individual mandate for enforcement. Increase in medical costs driven by utilization, and then also the Oregon Reinsurance Program, which we just talked about, there's an estimate of a 6% decrease based on that program. So in the small group market, we approved rates for 9 companies, and the average rate increases for that was 3.3% to 10.1%. And the reasons for those changes are the same as in the individual market. So the COFA Health Oral Health Program, Senate Bill 147 required DCBS to develop recommendations for a program to cover oral health care costs for low-income COFA Oregonians. So DCBS convened an advisory group. That group met in person twice over the summer. The group included COFA community members, oral health experts, and enrollment assisters. So DCBS staff and the staff of the Oregon Health Authority and the advisory group looked at 3 potential models for the COFA dental program. The Oregon Health Plan's managed care dental benefits, the Oregon Health Plan's fee-for-service open card dental coverage plan, and a program relying on commercial dental plans. So after the review and discussion, the advisory group preferred either of the 2 Oregon health plans benefit models. This is due to neither of these plans rely on the patients to pay out of pocket and then request reimbursement. And the concerns were that a reimbursement model could present barriers to care for participants. So the staff did gather cost data to estimate the cost of the program, but was unable to produce reliable comparisons because there's not enough known on the out-of-pocket models on commercial plans. So the report was submitted last Friday, September 15th, to the legislature. And what the study is asking for is to go back out, have the agency go back out and do an RFP to get some demographics about how many participants we would have, and also a request for information to the dental providers to ask about who would be interested, you know, get an estimate of participation, and also gather some information on out-of-cost pocket claims to see what the costs would be so that we would have better information to make a decision.
Were the PEB dental plans considered as an option?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that, sir?
This one, were the PEB dental plans considered as an option?
For the record, my name is Chickie Flowers. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace, representative Green Lake members of the committee. I believe that is not one of the options that was considered by the advisory committee.
Thank you. Is there any other questions? Is there anything else you want to talk to us about?
No.
You did great. Great opening shot.
Hopefully I made up some of your time.
We'll see you back.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. We're almost back on schedule. Can I ask Zeke Smith to join us to talk about the Oregon Health Policy Board? Welcome, young man.
Thank you. Thank you.
To remind the board, we talked in a past session when Mr. Smith joined us here about ways to strengthen the ability of the board to take on more important functions in the healthcare. We think the board is a very important institution for us, and we're really happy to have you here.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick.
Vice Chairs Nose and Hayden, and committee members. It's a pleasure to be here, so really appreciate the invitation again to come back and share where the Health Policy Board is at this point. Specifically, was asked to provide some information about the role of the board and our responsibilities, the relationship with the Oregon Health Authority, alignment with the Legislative Assembly, with the Governor's Office, and with other health committees, and then to share some of our vision and priorities for the future of health policy. So prepared a presentation to do such. I will try not to belabor points that you already know and understand, but I'm sure that if I do, you'll let me know that I'm doing such, and I'll move faster. Hope to have some real discussion and dialogue about the alignment and the vision and priorities as we move forward. The Health Policy Board has been in place since 2009, was formed with support from the legislature to guide the new Oregon Health Authority through House Bill 2009, as you know, and was filed at the request of this committee. This timeline really just provides a high-level picture of the activities of the board since its inception. And I think from my limited history, I've been on the board since 2013, just a recognition that the role of the board shifts over time as both our focus as a state has changed around health transformation, but also as leadership at a state level changes as well. And we've been really invested in thinking about what's the right role for the Health Policy Board as we move forward. Just also to acknowledge that the board has served a key role in a number of different ways throughout that process. This slide represents the membership on our board. We currently have 8 members out of 9 total positions available. We have 2 new members since the last time that I spoke to this board, Dr. John Santa, who has extensive experience both as a physician and working in the healthcare field. He currently works for Open Notes based out of Massachusetts, although he lives here. He has a lot of experience working in this field and has also played a role with previous iterations of the health department or health authority in Oregon as well. And then the second member who's newest to our board is Dr. David Bangsberg. He's an Oregon native who has been out of state for a while but is recently back. He's the new and founding dean of the OHSU and PSU School of Public Health and was previously a professor at Harvard School of Medicine and the Harvard Chan School of Public Health. Also comes with an extensive resume. And we're excited to have both of these new members as we think they bring significant and extensive experience in the health field.
Did he train with you upset of you?
He did.
Also want to point out on the right side of the slide that we have specific staff in the Oregon Health Authority who support the Health Policy Board. Currently, that I would say includes Interim Director Pat Allen, who you all just spoke to, as well as the Interim Health Policy and Analytics Division Director, Jeremy Vandehay, and other staff in the Health Authority. Just to give you a picture of kind of who's in the mix. In terms of roles and responsibilities, the Health Policy Board is charged to be the policymaking and oversight body for the Health Authority. The board's charge is really built on the Action Plan for Health, which I'll talk about a little bit in a moment, and is an expansion of the work of the Oregon Health Fund Board, which was the predecessor. And we see our focus as being intentionally about expanding access, transforming care, and being intentional about lowering costs across the system. We fulfill our duties by providing a venue for public and stakeholder expertise and input on important health issues. That's included the Action Plan for Health, Oregon's 1115 waiver, the future of coordinated care as a model and organizations, and then also providing public testimony at our meetings. We also provide policy oversight to the Oregon Health Authority in meeting the triple aim, or the goal around expanded access, transforming care, and lower costs. That includes input on primary care, payment reform, vaccines, so issues that go somewhat beyond the initial charge of the Health Policy Board. We provide guidance to coordinated care organizations and inform the coordinated care model. I'll come back and talk a little bit about that and interaction with both the committee and the legislature. We are a place to vet policy recommendations that come from work groups or from associated partners or coordinated related health policy, so behavioral health collaborative work, healthcare workforce committees. I'll speak to you a little bit about both committees that are in the purview of the policy board, as well as other committees that are focused on health and how we are intentional about thinking about alignment in the work. And then, of course, we have a number of statutory mandates, some of which increase as time goes on, including specifically studying and recommending provider recruitment and retention strategies, reporting on data regarding nurse payment parity and other issues. So these issues are pulled from statutes and are, I would say, still relevant in the work we do. There are other responsibilities as well, but I wanted to highlight these. We meet these charges to the and are charged as a board and authorized to do this through statute, subject to the approval of the governor in a few ways. We have the authority to organize and reorganize the Oregon Health Authority as we consider necessary to properly conduct the work. We can submit directly to the Legislative Council no later than October 1st of each even-numbered year, request for measures necessary to provide statutory authorization to carry out board's duties or to implement recommendations. And we can request waivers or other approval that's necessary. And I point that out because I want to acknowledge that there, this is a board that has a significant opportunity to impact health transformation in this state and to address the reality that how we interact and engage with the health authority and with other committees to the question that was presented by the chair is really critical. We have a number of committees that operate.
That's an extremely strong ability. I think most boards need to go through the governor when they submit legislative concepts. You guys can bring it right to the LC.
Chair Greenlee,
start taking advantage of that.
I would defer to your extensive understanding of the legislative process and the roles and responsibilities that boards have, but it is also my understanding that that is a rare opportunity and one not to be taken lightly, but also an authority that an authorization that should be used when necessary. And that is part of what we've been looking at as a health policy board as we think about the kind of role we want to play and the interaction and engagement with the legislature and other state bodies as we move forward. So we have a series of committees, both by statute and that we've created, that operate under the purview of the Health Policy Board. This is an important element of what I wanted to share today, because much of the work that actually gets done is going to be done in the context of these committees. And so we see our role as a Health Policy Board as both creating a space for the work of those committees to become visible, being intentional about what we move to kind of codify as policy, and in effect refereeing how that work moves through our work and then through onto either the legislature or to the health authority. We have members of the Health Policy Board that serve as liaisons or as consultants to each of these committees to ensure that we've got real clear and transparent communication. And are intentional about the role that the Health Policy Board can play in moving on key deliverables and policy issues. And that has been strengthened over the last few years. It's been we've been more intentional about trying to create that relationship and to ensure that that we're doing our work to make sure that the great work that the committees are doing can move forward and that we can address issues for Oregonians. In 2015, the Public Health Advisory Board, the Health Information Technology Committee, and the Health Plan Quality Metrics Committees were all added as subcommittees of the Health Policy Board. So over time, we've seen an increase in the both alignment, but also in the responsibility as a board to be paying attention to and moving work through those committees. We also chartered an equity committee in early 2017. We have a charter in place, and we just put membership in place for this committee. We've asked that committee to operate in relationship to each of these other subcommittees and to provide both guidance and recommendations about how to ensure that we're effectively using a health equity lens in the context of the policymaking that those committees are doing. And we've also asked them to provide us with the same guidance. We've also asked them to engage the health authority directly in providing feedback and recommendations around how to ensure that an equity lens is effectively guiding and moving in the work. There's a few committees on the right-hand side that are not Oregon Health Policy Board committees, so to speak, but are health authority committees where the work is specifically relevant and important to the Health Policy Board. One example of that is the Medicaid Advisory Committee. In your packets, we included a letter and a set of principles that the MAC developed recently to kind of put in place a framework as we consider potential changes at the federal level. Those principles are aligned with the Health Policy Board's priorities and really serve as guidance, I think, for us as a state and for at a federal level as we navigate potential changes that come at a different level. I think in particular, I would point out that those principles were developed in the context and the understanding that we may be facing reductions in resources that are available for this work, and that we wanted to have, they wanted to have a set of foundational principles that could help to guide how we still focus on patients and on improving healthcare delivery as we navigate that, as opposed to rolling back eligibility benefits or funding levels. Hope that you have a chance to review that, and it's a good example where we're working directly with committees to ensure that there's alignment and connection. And you'll hear me use the word alignment a lot because I think it's one of the questions that people have asked about our relationship with the health authority, and we also want to point that out in our relationships with other committees. So speaking of our relationship with the health authority, we, as I had mentioned, have responsibility for overall vision on policymaking with health authority. We have a healthy relationship with the health authority. We're, in addition to setting vision and identifying priority issues, we have worked with the health authority to ensure that their work is aligned with those priorities and that there's clarity and transparency around that alignment. And that you can tie that work back to the board's policy priorities, which you'll see in our action plan for health. We also, as you know, respond on occasion to the governor and or to the legislature directly on a variety of topics and issues that we've been asked to take on. I want to pause for a moment and say that as we think about our role in terms of oversight and accountability with the Oregon Health Authority, in particular, we've thought of that as a place where our role is to help both set those priorities and then to ensure that there's alignment in the health authority. We're not responsible for oversight and management of the, or we're not responsible for management of the health authority. That's a relationship between the director and the governor, and you all have a role in that as well. But we see our responsibility as ensuring that there's clarity around the way that the that a core set of priorities and principles are guiding the work, and that there remains intentional focus on the consumers, on the patients, and who and Oregonians who need those services. I would also say that we are staffed by the Oregon Health Authority as a board, and so are our committees. This includes facilitation at times. They draft our materials and have administrative responsibilities. I focus as the chair of the Health Policy Board in partnership with Jeremy Vandehay and Interim Director Pat Allen on ensuring that the staff are really supporting our committees effectively and supporting the Health Policy Board, both in terms of the staffing work, but also in terms of the analytics that's required to be able to take positions on critical policy issues. So much of how we see our role in doing that at this point is through our Action Plan for Health. The Action Plan was initially developed by the board in 2010 as a way to guide the coordinated care implementation and the oversight of the health policy of the health authority. We have engaged in a refresh of that action plan over the last year, and we'll be putting out a new action plan for 2017-19 shortly. It's in kind of the final stage, and we'll ensure that you all have a copy of that. It's intentionally framed as a two-year time frame. We spent a lot of time trying to identify priorities that we believe kind of last beyond that two-year period, but wanted to be able to develop a work plan and to ensure that the health authority has a work plan that's clear about what we want to accomplish in that two-year period of time. So the action plan itself lays out those priorities. It's intentional about pushing on the boundaries of the health system innovation and on collaboration. And it, in addition to the kind of guiding principles, has a set of foundational strategies that we've asked the health authority to use to organize how it's thinking about its work. There's a kind of a tracking tool that aligns with that action plan, where it gets pretty detailed into specific bodies of work that the health authority is engaged in. And we'll be using that over time to measure progress towards anticipated and expected outcomes and goals, and to make adjustments as necessary as we move forward. This slide, in effect, takes those guiding principles that the Health Policy Board has agreed upon and then shows you kind of core buckets of work that the health authority is engaged in the context of those specific guiding principles. So, again, this is really about ensuring and getting clear about the kind of alignment that is necessary to tie implementation to the policy work as we see it, and creating a mechanism for monitoring effective progress towards that or not, and then having a means to address that as it's not happening, and or to celebrate it as we see the right kind of progress being made around those key issues. So as we move forward, there's a few areas that we as a board are very invested in terms of our vision and our priorities. We will be overseeing the progress on this action plan, and we'll use that as a mechanism to monitor progress. We'll continue to focus on how we're aligning both with the health authority, but also across those committees that we identified, and ensuring that work is surfacing at an effective level. There's a few specific areas that we see either an urgent need to move and or where we see some opportunity for innovation. Reducing the price of high-cost drugs is one of those places. Our board is very invested in an increased urgency around how we're doing that, not just in our Medicaid system, but also in our private system, but in particular, thinking about what we can do through our coordinated care model to address developing a more sustainable cost for prescription drugs and high-cost drugs. And we're looking at whether or not there's a value and an opportunity to do that through a single preferred drug list or other mechanisms to address those issues. We believe we've got to continue to make more and more urgent improvement in addressing behavioral health issues and getting different outcomes there, and that has to be done in an integrated way. We believe to the point of some of the conversation earlier today that we need to focus more on social determinants of health and be intentional and specific about how that can show up in the implementation of our work, both through our coordinated care organizations and through the Oregon Health Authority. We want to see improved integration, not just with behavioral health, but also with oral health as well, and are interested in how we can continue to monitor what's working in the coordinated care model and spread it to other public systems as well as the private side. And then we have this responsibility given to us by the legislature around the Health Plan Quality Metrics Committee to ensure that we're building a more effective and efficient system for measuring progress in our health care system and working with our partners there to do that. I want to come back and say the other kind of large piece of work that we see as an area that we want to that we have a responsibility for in the coming years is around the next phase of CCO contracting and the coordinated care model as a whole. As you may remember, we put some time and effort with a lot of Oregonians into a series of discussions, listening sessions, where we heard from Oregonians about what's working and what's not working in the coordinated care model. We took all that information from across the state and turned it into a set of recommendations for either changes or continued progress that we wanted to see in the coordinated care system, and delivered those recommendations to the governor, to the legislature, and to this committee at the chair's request. Those didn't move quite as far in the last legislative session as we were interested, and so we see part of that as an opportunity for us to be more specific and clear about some of those recommendations that we'd like to see in terms of changes that need to occur. We also want to take the time to ensure that we can identify what's the right level at which those changes need to happen. So which of those require legislative action, and how can we come back to you and work through that process? Which of those does the health authority already have? Are they already in a position to make change, and how do we as the policy body ensure that they're working towards that? And where are some of those changes happening at local levels? So that's work that's in front of us that we feel is really important. One of the core and immediate questions, of course, is how that aligns with the CCO contracting process. We've been in dialogue with both the director and with the governor's office about their considerations, as you just heard, in terms of that process. I would say that the policy board is very interested in ensuring that we've got the right policy framework on the front end of what will be a very significant and important decision for this state around how to and with whom to move forward in our continuation of the coordinated care model. So we intend to do that. I'm going to pause there.
The place where that's going to be expressed formally, short of us having a bill, and a bill will be back in the short session tomorrow, is in the RFA. And it would really be useful to me, to us, I hope, is if you take some role in the drafting of that RFA for the next round of CCOs along with the health authority. When I met first with the new director, the new interim director, I pointed out he ought to view the Health Policy Board as his board of directors. In the sense that, in my view of the way a board of directors acts, it helps on the policy side rather than in the management side. But the development of that RFA has big policy consequences. I feel much more comfortable and less worried about passing a bill here if I saw your recommendations from the CCO deliberations showing up as guiding principles in the RFA that's going to emerge. So take that under consideration.
Chair Greenlick, committee members, thank you for the recommendation. I think, are very aligned in our consideration of what that process needs to look like moving forward. The Health Policy Board is very invested in ensuring that we've got the right framework for those decisions moving forward, and that there's an ability to articulate what kinds of change we want to see over the next five-year period of time. I will say I am in no way a expert on public bureaucracy, which I'm pretty happy about. And don't intend to be, but I know that it's a complicated process to make a set of decisions like with the amount of resources that are invested in what that will look like through the next process. The process itself, I would say, is the responsibility of the state government and the health authority. But the framework we want to use and the kinds of changes we need to see, the policy board has taken a very strong vested interest in ensuring we can get clear about that. And I am hopeful that we can really have and take the time to do that in a real intentional way so that we can actually make most of those changes within the framework we already have and not have to come back to the legislature for additional authority other than where we need it, in which case you can expect that we will engage you in that conversation.
Yeah, I would love to see your recommendations implemented in the next RFA.
Chair Greenlick, as would I.
How often does this committee meet? This is like, they have a lot.
Speak up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Zeke, can you tell us how often, this is a pretty comprehensive bulk of work here. How often are you meeting?
Vice Chair Noss, Chair Greenlick, and committee members. We meet on a monthly basis. It's a four-hour meeting once a month. At this point, there was a period where we were taking a month off in the summer. We don't feel like we have the liberty to do that, given the amount of work that's there. I will say that, as I was indicating before, a lot of the work, if done right, happens at other points in the system, right? So it either happens through subcommittees where they're really grappling with and wrestling with the issues, and or it's happening through appropriate and effective staffing. And that's where I think part of our job is really the refereeing of how we're moving those issues. There are some core issues that require really direct and immediate work from the policy board, and this coordinated care model and the coordinated care system and the role that the coordinated care organizations play in it is one of those areas that we've chosen to be really intentional. So part of the job, I think, of moving the work at the policy board level is to be judicious about where we're going to spend the most of our energy. And so those priorities and the prioritization process becomes really important each year.
It looks like you're undertaking quite a lot, so...
And he's actually not a full-time employee.
Right.
You have another life as well.
Chair Greenlick and committee members, worth noting that every 2 years it seems like that load gets a little bit larger, and I think you all have a role in that.
I'm going to propose one other addition to your workload that you can share. You pointed out you have the authority for organizing and reorganizing the health authority. This is a perfect time to look at. My impression was the table of organization in existence now is totally crazy. Now you have a new administrator, and I hope a new permanent administrator soon. It might be a good time to work with them to rethink their table of organization. I think it's an opportunity to help.
Chair Greenlick, committee members, thank you for that advice.
Yes, if you could go back to your committee slides, please. The many committees you guys have. That one. So you said that the Health Equity Committee just started in 2017. I wanted to make sure I understood you correctly. That committee oversees potential policy or bills that go forward to make sure that there's an equity lens applied to it. Is that what I heard?
Representative Alonso Leon, Chair Greenlick, other members of the committee, that is correct. It is a new committee that was chartered, I think, 3 months ago, mm-hmm. and we just approved the membership at our last meeting. Really excited about that membership as it represents a significant diversity both geographically and by race and home community. Happy to share that charter with committee members, but in particular there, I would say, are three parts to that. One is to ensure that the Health Policy Board and that other committees are intentional about the use of an equity lens in policy work that's moving forward, and building a structure for supporting that. Secondly, to provide guidance to the health authority and review of the health authority's work and ensure that there's also clarity about the effective use of an equity lens and intentionality around affecting health disparities and inequities. And then third, to look at the broader health community and identify where those disparities are most significant and how to provide recommendations, which may ultimately look like policy recommendations about where we should be focusing intentionality addressing those issues.
Thank you. Follow up, Chair. Is that okay? Remind me, do you also provide that kind of level of oversight or recommendations to the CCOs?
Representative Alonso León, Chair Greenlick, committee members, yes, we would see that as a part of the role that they would play in terms of oversight and guidance on the system. At the kind of individual CCO level, I think we would end up in a position where, one, I think it's important that the health authority actually has plays a strong role in managing and addressing that issue with those individual CCOs. But it is a part of the system, and so we'll be looking at that both broadly, and we would ask the committee to be intentional about where they see issues coming up.
Well, I just want to applaud OHPB for creating this particular committee. As you all know, I've mentioned many times in my first year session how important it is to make sure that when we are addressing any issue, that we look at it through the diverse equity social justice lens to make sure that everybody has the exact same communication in multiple languages, that we have interpretation, translation services that are appropriate to make sure that, you know, all of our members of our community are receiving the utmost best health care because, you know, there have been, you know, just stories that I've heard, and I want us to change that focus and help make sure that everybody feels like they belong wherever they go get health services. So thank you for that. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to hearing the work associated to this particular committee. Very interested in, you know, continuing to have conversations. Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Alonso León, other committee members, thank you for your continued investment in health equity. To be clear, the policy board has seen this as a priority for the entire time that I've been there and since before. This is a mechanism to really begin to get tangible about how we ensure that we're making change. I also want to acknowledge that there were a number of community members who had been asking for this level of oversight and connection to the health policy board around health equity and put in a lot of effort with the health authority and then ultimately with the health policy board to ensure that we get it right as we put this committee together. And so we're excited about the work that they're going to do and hope that you will hold us accountable to making progress.
I think you want to share with the committee what your everyday job is.
Chair Greenlick and committee members, I'd be happy to. I work at the United Way of the Columbia Willamette, so the United Way that is in the Portland metro region, and I oversee all of how we make an impact and an investment in the community in that role. We've put a particular focus on addressing issues of poverty and know that that means we have to be really explicit and clear about how poverty and its impacts have differential impacts on different communities. In our community, that means communities of color, and we are focused on working to address that. So good alignment between that as I have my working hat on and my volunteer hat on.
Wonderful. Thank you, Zeke.
Do you have anything else you want to share with us at the moment?
Chair Greenlick, committee members, I would be happy to, but in the interest of time, I will defer.
I'm really pleased to have you back. I'm really delighted the way that the board is moving into this. Representative Noe set an amazing agenda. We'll just keep trying to overburden you with more things.
Chair Greenlick, we'll look forward to that.
Thank you, Zeke.
Thank you.
We have two more sets of agenda items. One is a kind of double item on acquired infections. And then we're going to talk a little bit about a certificate of need. We have two parts of the acquired infection thing. We're going to get somebody on the phone. Want to do that?
They're on the second panel.
They're on the second panel.
Aye, aye.
You want to wait for the second panel?
Yeah.
To do that? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Good. You call the first panel? No, they're here.
Yeah.
Right on schedule.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and committee members for the opportunity to speak on the extremely important topic of healthcare-associated infections, multi-drug-resistant organisms, and MRSA. For the record, my name is Zince Beldavs. I manage the communicable disease section of the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm going to talk about some findings that we have from the upcoming healthcare-associated infection report, which will be in October will be coming out.
You make sure all the members of the committee get that report.
Absolutely. Representative Klinik. So the report, and along with that, I wanted to touch briefly on some of the prevention efforts that we have in place to try to prevent the spread of infections. So the report covers 61 different hospitals and 60 freestanding dialysis facilities. There are 11 different kinds of healthcare-associated infections included in the report. And a lot of things are going in a positive direction for Oregon in terms of healthcare-associated infections. So specifically for that, central line-associated bloodstream infections associated in pediatric and adult settings, MRSA bloodstream infections, coronary artery bypass graft surgery, laminectomy, colon and hysterectomy surgical site infections are all meeting HHS targets. So that's national targets set by the Health and Human Services Department. And they also are exceeding the CDC baselines. So of note for this specific topic to get today, Oregon has 39% fewer MRSA bloodstream infections than were predicted. Now, a number of things are not going in the direction that we would like at this point, unfortunately. And specifically, I wanted to call out C. difficile infection is not meeting national HHS targets. Neither are central line-associated bloodstream infections in neonatal intensive care units or surgical site infections associated with coronary or associated with hip or knee replacement surgeries. So these are not currently meeting targets. Of note, 15% of hip replacement surgery were also associated with MRSA. So that's for this specific topic today. Now, we have a number of different prevention initiatives that we have established, and we are working towards further initiatives as well. Specifically, what we are doing is targeting facilities that have high rates of healthcare-associated infections and evaluating the facilities for appropriate infection control practices and then providing recommendations for improvement. We also require reporting statewide of carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae, so that's also called CRE. Carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae is an extremely drug-resistant organism that is rapidly spreading throughout the country and the rest of the world. And so we do intense investigation on any individual case of carbapenemase producers, which are the most concerning variety of these. And at this point, it appears that Oregon has no indication of transmission of carbapenemase producers, despite the fact that they are rapidly spreading in the rest of the world and including in surrounding states. We provide guidance and support for C. difficile and MDROs. We are one of the first states to institute a requirement for interfacility transfer notification of multi-drug resistant organisms or C. difficile. So,
C. diff related to antibiotic use.
So C. difficile is related to antibiotic use because overuse of antibiotics results in disruption of the gut flora, and then as a result, a person is more likely to have C. difficile infection. So that's kind of the main way that that's related. And so I was actually kind of horrified when I first heard of this, the fact that that facilities did not have to notify each other when a patient is transmitted with MDROs or C. difficile. And so it's very good that we have this requirement in place that now people can put appropriate infection control precautions in place when they receive patients from receiving facilities. We are also promoting antibiotic stewardship statewide in all different facility settings and doing various other efforts that I'm not going to talk about at this moment. I was going to pass it off to my colleague, Dr. J.J. Furuno, who sits on our advisory committee and as the academic member of the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs Noss and Hayden. Nice to be here. For the record, my name is John Furuno. I'm an associate professor at Oregon State and OHSU in the College of Pharmacy. And I'm primarily speaking in my capacity as the academic member of the Healthcare Associated Infections Advisory Committee. But because I'm an academic, my worlds collide in my day job and my volunteer job. For the HAI Advisory Committee was established in 2009. Our primary role is to provide recommendations to OHA with respect to their activities surrounding healthcare-associated infections. We're mandated by statute, as I'm sure you all know. And our representation includes members from various hospital sizes, as well as academia, trade groups, quality organizations, the consumer, the public, et cetera. Some of the key, and I've been the academic member for the past 3 years on the committee. Some of our key recommendations included the center facility transfer rule, which went into effect in 2014 was also supported by the committee to help bring up to speed all the different aspects of the healthcare community that involved not just hospitals and long-term care facilities, but also transport, home health, and those types of groups as well. Some of the other recommendations or requirements that we've been discussing include implementing a statewide registry to help and capacity to help further support compliance with the interfacility transfer rule, to require antimicrobial stewardship throughout the healthcare continuum. As you may know, CMS now requires, effective November 28th of this year, skilled nursing facilities to now have antimicrobial stewardship programs. Requiring reporting of antimicrobial use and antimicrobial resistance, as CDC refers to this as AUAR. So we're seeing the antibiotic pressure that's going in and resulting in antibiotic resistance. Requiring education, so for people that are performing antibiotic stewardship and performing infection prevention, do they have the appropriate training to performing these tasks? And in reinforcing this one health approach, this one health idea of the interface between humans and animals, we are not the only, certainly the only organisms, if you will, that are using antimicrobial agents, and this interface either in the food chain or directly has been seen as a key player in transmission of these organisms. I'll stop there, but I'm happy to expand on any of those recommendations or any of our other activities.
Well, I'd really like you to make sure we get the report. I don't remember getting that report in the past couple of years. I assume you do it regularly.
Chair Greenlake, I apologize if you did not get the report. It was published last year, and so we'll make sure to that you have the report.
Make sure we get it, and then absolutely, we can bring you back in November to talk specifically about it.
Absolutely.
It's individual facility name, right?
Chair Greenlake, that is correct. It is individual facilities are named so that...
Hold on, please.
Yes, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm hoping that they can come back in November, and I'd love to hear more about the transmission of antibiotics through animal manure from farms into streams and things like that. I understand that's a big concern and a big method of overabundance of antibiotics.
Sure. Chair Greenlick, Representative, forgive me if I mispronounce your last
name.
committee members, that's an excellent point. I certainly we've effluent from animal fields. We know that a lot of antibiotic use a lot of antibiotics are used in animal husbandry and for different reasons, for prophylaxis, for treatment, and so I think we don't have a great understanding of exactly the magnitude of that association with human health. I think some of our and this is more of my hat as an academic, even though I don't work in this particular area, You know, some of our ability now to track specific organisms and, you know, will, I think, inform on that. I think some of the One Health approach and working with our veterinary colleagues and others is to really help, I think, capture the magnitude of that association and, I think, optimal prevention methods. So.
Just a quick follow-up. I know Osberg, both at the state level and the national level, Public Interest Research Group, has done a lot of work on this, and I think it'll be great to connect them. I'll certainly try to connect them with you on this issue.
A separate question, but one an interesting one for us. Thank you very much for your presentation. We have a couple of folks talking to us specifically on MRSA, I think.
We do. Janine Thomas, do we have you, founder and president of MRSA?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. And we also have two other presenters. So if Regina Ibrahim and Teresa Mazik will come up as well.
Thank you very much.
Should we vacate?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and committee members.
You.
Thank you, Chairman Greenlick and committee members, for the opportunity to speak today concerning MRSA and HAI legislation. I profusely apologize for not being able to attend in person, as I have a severe ear infection and I was not able to fly. And I was not able to do slides because we are in the throes of World MRSA Day and World MRSA Awareness Month also. I just want to give you a little background about my organization, who I am, and what I have been doing to help prevent and bring transparency to MRSA and HAIs. I was the first patient and consumer to raise the alarm in the U.S. about MRSA, C. diff, and HAIs in 2002. I am a founder and president of MRSA Survivors Network, and founded it in 2003, and also World MRSA Day. And I'm a survivor of MRSA, sepsis, osteomyelitis, and C. diff. Was critically ill, and I was infected by ankle surgery in 2000. And I survived, and I had septic shock and multiple organ failure. So this raised my alarm of how I could nearly die from ankle surgery, and what was this disease. More Americans die every year from MRSA than from HIV/AIDS. According to the CDC, there were only 90,000 MRSA infection rates in the U.S., but this is only a fraction, as they are only counting invasive MRSA infections, which are bloodstream, catheter, and UTIs, and not including surgical site, which is 90% of all MRSA healthcare-acquired MRSA infections. So they're just extrapolating. In 2003, the Illinois State Senator Barack Obama introduced the Hospital Report Card Act, which mandated HAIs be publicly reported, and it was enacted in 2004. That was the first in the country. Now over 30 states have public reporting of HAIs. And that is when I joined the state advisory board as a patient representative. In 2006, I initiated universal screening for MRSA in Illinois, and we had to go into committee. The next year, we changed it to screening ICU and other at-risk patients, and it passed unanimously in the Illinois House and Senate, and was enacted in August of 2007, which was the first in the country, and it was based on the 2003 SHAE guidelines for controlling MDROs, which is multi-drug-resistant organisms. And there is over 300 evidence-based, peer-reviewed studies now that support screening, active detection, and isolation works for controlling MRSA. In 2007, the VA health system started screening all patients upon admission and had reduced their MRSA infection rates by 87% in their ICUs and 80% in all other units. In 1980, the Netherlands started screening patients for MRSA, putting those positive in isolation and decolonizing them. They now have less than 1% prevalence in the facility, as does Scandinavian countries. In 2006, it was estimated that in Illinois, over 30,000 patients were infected with MRSA, just MRSA only, in Illinois hospitals, according to the CMS discharge data. The latest data, which is 2015, shows we have 17,500 patients infected, and we are still at epidemic levels but we have drastically reduced. The National Institute of Health came out in 2009 saying Chicago and Baltimore were ground zero for MRSA in the U.S. So this is what we have had the most infections. We are reducing it by screening. In 2007, I worked with U.S. Senator Dick Durbin and the late Senator Kennedy and Senator Menendez on federal bill for MRSA screening and reporting. And also later in 2009 with a bill with Representative Spears from California. They concluded that this was a state's right issue. What is needed is a comprehensive approach to reducing MRSA infections, screening, isolation, and decolonizing, strict adherence to hand hygiene, and thoroughly decontaminating the environment, and prudent use of antibiotics. You cannot change what you do not acknowledge, and that is why it is important to publicly report infection rates. Transparency is needed with public reporting and on death certificates.
You know, we've had public reporting in Oregon for many, many years now.
Well, I only saw your data from 2003 and 2004. That's all I could find. But anyway, in 2011, I introduced the Illinois MRSA death certificate bill, which mandated MRSA be put on death certificates if it is a contributing factor or cause of death. We were able to add also C. diff and VRE to the bill, and it passed unanimously. Washington State and California have that legislation now. I'm currently working with the World Health Organization on a global surveillance program. I've been on their Ebola virus panel for the Ethics Committee and with the World Health Organization since 2008 and with the FDA on the Anti-Infective Advisory Board for Drug Development. Infections are estimated to cost the U.S. Billions of dollars annually. And CMS, along with insurance providers, absorb that cost. The public pays higher insurance premiums and deductibles to pay for these preventable infections. The true number of MRSA infections is vastly underreported and not included in the ICD-10 codes. It is estimated that nearly 500,000 are not captured in the codes, and the health facilities are doing, 50% of them now are doing active detection and isolation, but we need every facility to be doing this. Looking at the Oregon Public Health CD summary, I was only able to find MRSA infection rates for 04 through 06. Then on the CDC website, I could find for Oregon the SIR, standardized infection ratio, but no data by pathogen. So if maybe it's there, but if I can't find it, neither can consumers. Let me tell you, or patients.
Is it on the? Did you check the website
hospital
of the hospital?
Hospitals are reporting to the CDC's NHSN system, and you have a state mandate to publicly report only at least one HAI. SIR data and percentages are virtually meaningless to consumers. What consumers want is true infection rates.
May I interrupt, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Hold on a second.
Janine? Janine, this is Oliver, Committee Minister. We have a question by a committee member.
Okay.
Janine, this is Representative Rob Nose. I'm sorry to interrupt. This is very interesting, actually. But I just want you to know, I was able to Google right now Healthcare Association Infection 2014. Now, maybe that's not as current as you would like, but it's a pretty big report. So, you know, maybe you just Googled the wrong thing, or I'm seeing the wrong thing. I'm just curious about that.
All right. Well, I couldn't find it. So that's
okay. Well, I just tried. You made me think about it, because that seems really out of date. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
On the website.
What I'm saying is MRSA and HAI are a medical error.
It's on the Oregon Health Authority's website.
If you Google
tolerance, you should be getting down to zero infections. One infection is too many.
Let's try. Yeah.
And this is
that's a good goal.
What we feel that we need to do is bring down to zero. If you have done everything you could or should have done to prevent these infections, why would you fear or feel threatened by legislation? And this is what we've said to every state. And mandated screening now is in Illinois, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Washington State, and in California, along with the 150 hospitals in the VA, which are screening 100% universally. So we know this is a try. This is what is needed to control MRSA by screening and not having the community-acquired strains coming into the hospital. And this is what is needed. And if you want to look at our website, we're not probably the best in Illinois. I think New York is. But we do have a consumer website from our, it's called healthcarereportcard.illinois.gov. And it does have statistics. We do a yearly report. It needs to be improved, and I've been on that committee since 2004. But there, what needs transparency so consumers can understand, not clinicians, but also consumers, your data, and this is really important. And screening, mandated screening is what you need.
But thank you. We need to move on to the next presenter now. Why don't you hang in and listen if you'd like to.
Yeah.
Who's next, please?
Well, I was saying that Janine is partners with this organization here, and so that was part of the presentation, her giving you the data. But just so that I can read, just for the record, my name is Teresa Rayford. For the record, it's not Mazik. Somebody's probably looking on.
Introduce yourself.
I'm sorry? Yeah, for the record, my name is Teresa Rayford. I'm a co-member of the organization Mercer PDX. I became an advocate for this family, as I do for a lot of families in our community, and my part of this testimony is just to advise that whatever innovation you bring to our state in regards to facilitating partnerships for people in needs of traumatic injury or any type of health-related support for equity or marginalized communities, that you please look at the relationships that we don't have in our community. When people are affected by infections in our hospitals, or a lot of these violations that happen to them, there's no one to support them. The work that we had to do in order to bring this family to this board was all that we had, their opportunity to learn this process and to bring the process in here so that they could be heard. And so I'm just here as an advocate saying that it shouldn't be grassroots organizers like myself. It should be coming through our Oregon distribution of resources to assist families in bringing these type of issues to this type of platform so that we can mandate legislation. So
thank you very much.
Just for the record.
Hi. Representative Greenlick and committee, thank you for having me here today. My name is Regina Ibrahim, for the record, and I am a Oregonian. I live in Portland in Multnomah County, and today I came to talk about what happened to my daughter. So I am the new founder of MRSA Awareness PDX. I decided that it was time that we did something here in Portland. And so I want to tell you the story about Nadia. Let me see if I can. This is my daughter, Nadia. She's 24 years old. And in 2014, Nadia became ill. And she blacked out at a concert, and I took her to OHSU, and they scanned her brain, and she had a pineal cyst in the middle of her brain. Mm. It got up to 18.64 within 90 days, and they had to do surgery. So she had pineal resection at Oregon Health and Science University on February 17, 2015. At her post-op checkup with Dr. Roslin, the assistant professor for neurosurgery, Nadia had a small nickel-sized amount of fluid underneath her incision. And she asked him, "What is this?" And he said, "Well, let's scan it and see." He said, "Oh, it's some fluid. It'll reabsorb." By March 10th, Nadia was having erratic behavior and unable to make small decisions. By the 16th of March, she was catatonic. I took her back to OHSU. After a neuro consult in the ER, they admitted her back into the neuro ward. On the 17th, they evaluated her. Her white blood cell count was 13.64, 6.0 is regular, so it was more than double.
Wow.
She actually escaped the neuro floor twice, once at midnight and then once in the morning, walking off, and she was held by security. I was called, and I came up to OHSU, and she had gloves and a mask on, screaming, "They're going to kill me. I'm infected." They then locked her in the psychiatric ward, and she was sedated. While she was in the psychiatric ward, March 23rd, Nadia blacked out while sitting in the day room and drinking water, hit her head on the concrete. And when I came to pick her up on the 25th, her head was swollen out gigantically where the incision was.
And they told me that she had had a CT, she had a hematoma, and it would reabsorb. I took Nadia home, I put her to bed as they told me to, and that evening, Nadia came downstairs in front of our entire family and told us that her head was infected and she was going to die if we didn't get it scanned again. I told her she needed to rest, I would take her in the morning. At 8 a.m. the following morning, I woke up to Nadia screaming. I ran upstairs, and the back of her head had blown open, and all infection was pouring out. I rushed her up to OHSU, and they admitted her immediately. They let her sit for 24 hours to drain the infection, and then on the 27th of March, she had an emergency flush. Nadia was diagnosed with MRSA infection, MSSA-sensitive staph, which is a hospital-acquired infection, on that date of that surgery. Her infection date was February 17th, the day of her pineal resectomy. And I had to make Nadia a Washington resident to get her any type of help. Nadia acquired a severe traumatic brain injury from this. I took her everywhere in Oregon. I can name the hospitals off if you wanted. And nobody would seem to help her. So she ended up in Washington, and a doctor in Washington State, Dr. Bernstein, he was kind enough to help us, and he told me that after he read her few medical records that he got from Oregon, that he suggested I never bring her back into Oregon for any medical care whatsoever. Aye. So I air ambulanced to Tulsa, Oklahoma with my daughter on March 15th of 2016, paid for by Washington State. They pay $30,000 a month for her to be in a traumatic brain injury facility.
They have 11 patients there
from Washington State. Mm. So to current date, this is what I did to try to acquire my daughter's medical records, because I still haven't gotten them. We ordered them from OHSU, but we don't have them. We're missing her post-operative reports from both surgeries, along with all of her brain scan panels, but eight. We contacted the DOJ, and they came to my home and sat in my living room. And they suggested I contact the Attorney General's Office for public record release. And I did contact the Attorney General's Office for public record release. And they told me that they could not help me. They told me to go to the DA, Multnomah County DA. So I contacted the Multnomah County DA. And they told me, what is the case number and what's the crime? I said, well, it's a federal crime. They said, well, you need to contact the U.S. Attorney's Office, which I did. And they said they couldn't help me. And then I contacted a civil attorney, George Kirkland. He was 51-year trial attorney with Lane Powell and Spears and now has Kirkland, Thompson, and Pope. And he went through all of Nadia's medical records that we had been given from OHSU, which was 506 pages. And eight photos of her brain. She had two brain surgeries, and she was up there for a month and a half, 2 months prior to that, dying in their hospital. There should be thousands and thousands of pages, and there should be hundreds of pictures of her brain, and we do not have them. So, Nadia is in a rehabilitation center for a neural issue, and we don't have any post-operative reports, and this is what MRSA does. This is totally... changed my entire family dynamic. It has devastated our family. You know, Nadia's brothers and sisters are just, you know, besides themselves, their oldest sister's gone. I'm beside myself. My oldest daughter's gone. And I do not want to see this happen to any other Oregonian family. And that's why I'm here, because there was no support for me. I didn't have anybody from HAI or whatever, anybody contact me or my daughter at the time. I had to become her guardian. I had to fight the system to become a guardian for this child. I mean, it's been a nightmare. And I can't imagine how many other families have had to go through this.
Well.
And I really believe that we need to have some serious bills put into legislation to make sure that we have mandatory testing. We have mandatory death certificate reporting, especially mandatory testing for, you know, people that are having any type of surgery, like brain surgery, or even like what Janine had, ankle surgery. It's so important. We're going in invasive into somebody's body, and these hospitals have these serious issues.
Well, we all, I'm sure, feel very sympathetic to this story. It's something we'll take up in the interim and see whether there's some legislation we can develop, particularly for the 2019 session.
And I would love to work with you to do that.
Well, I really have you would. On the list.
Yeah.
And we'll keep in touch with you. Thank you both very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I'm really excited to hear that story.
Yeah, well, you know, I had to come tell you guys.
Yeah.
You need, if you don't know, if I don't share the information, how can you help other families?
We appreciate you doing that.
Thank you. I appreciate you listening to me today.
Thank you, Greenlink. Just one question, and thank you for your presentation. Of all the people that you went through to try and get the medical records, I didn't see the Oregon Medical Board on there.
I contacted Dan Lilly.
Okay.
I think that's who I was told to contact from Governor Brown. And they told me all they would do was the medical board would deal with Dr. Roslin's license, and that's not what I'm trying to do.
We need legislation.
Well, healthcare professionals have some very strict rules on when they have to provide those medical records, you know, amount of days. And
right.
So, okay.
Great. 30 days, yeah, we know. Yeah. We're waiting. We're still waiting.
Okay.
We have one more topic. Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you so much.
We're going to talk about certificate of need. And I want to frame, if we have the next panel join us, I want to frame the issue. This is not about Cedar Hill's request for certificate of need.
It's not.
It's not about that. That's not the topic. And that's in lawsuit, and we best stay out of it.
Okay.
What the topic here is the history of certificate of need, why we had it, what it's done in the past, and we need it for the future. Let's ask ourselves the question about our legislative agenda. And is this something we need to address? So I thought it would be very useful to share with the committee a little background. We've got, we're basically right on schedule. We have 20 minutes for this topic. If you would.
Sure. Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Justin Black. I'm the Director of Government Relations at OHA. And in those duties, I often drive PowerPoint presentations. So I'll be up here driving the PowerPoint presentation, but I'm also here to introduce Dr. Sulliver, who is our Section Manager for Healthcare Regulation and Quality Improvement, and is going to do most of this presentation. But just wanted to highlight the fact that she has worked with NCSL on some of the national information that is in the PowerPoint. We've been asked to kind of move a little quicker through the PowerPoint, so we're going to skip some of the maps. But we recommend that they have a great website on this. And also, in the outreach to them, they offered to come back to the committee if you guys want to dive deeper into the actual policy. Yeah, because I think most of today's presentation from us will be more on kind of logistics and how the process works and how someone kind of gets through it. And what it's done. So I think we will see that. On a deeper policy conversation of this, we would recommend reaching out to them and working through some of them. And with that, I'll hand it over.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Dana Sulliver. Again, I'm the Section Manager for Healthcare Regulation and Quality Improvement at the Public Health Division. Representative Greenlink, members of the committee, happy to be here today. Our program does a lot of things, and I wanted to make sure that that you know that beyond Certificate of Need, we do have the health facility licensing, not long-term care, but hospitals, ambulatory surgery, home health, in-home care, hospice, things like that. We also have the EMS and trauma program. In this presentation, I do want to begin with two national slides, and I will skip through the other ones. Certificate of Need programs across the country, they're really aimed at restraining healthcare costs and facilitating coordinated planning of new services and new facility construction. There are basic assumptions, and I will tell you now, I'm not going to talk about the pros and cons and the advocates and the opponents, because there are both of those. But I will say that the basic assumption Certificate of Need across the country is that excess capacity from overbuilding, if you build too many facilities, too many beds, that it does result in some level of healthcare price inflation, and that can occur when you have a large facility that has only a few beds and they have high fixed costs, and so they end up charging more for those few residents that they do have in the facility. And this happens both in what we call non-long-term care hospitals and long-term care also. And about 18 states, as we hear from the National Conference of State Legislatures, introduced about 82 bills in 2017, and we have that information also if you're interested in that. And New Hampshire is the most recent state to repeal their Certificate of Need program. We'll move on to the next one. Here's a very brief flyover of the history of Certificate of Need. In 1946, the Hill-Burton Act was passed to increase the capacity of medical facilities. I'm assuming after the Second World War, they needed a little bit more resources and capacity. So the federal government provided grants and loans both to hospitals, nursing homes, and other facility types, including outpatient care clinics, for modernization. And in return for that, the facilities were obligated to provide a reasonable amount of services to persons who were unable to pay or had a reduced ability to pay, and make those services available to all those residing in their service area. Although Certificate of Need did end in Hill-Burton ended in 1997, there are still about 140 facilities nationwide that are obligated to provide some free and reduced care. In Oregon, a couple of examples is Dornbecker Children's Hospital and Pioneer Memorial Hospital in Heppner. In 1964, you can see New York was the first state to implement a Certificate of Need program. And then in 1974, the federal government tied the state, or funding, a lot of the federal government funding, to the state adoption of state Certificate of Need programs. They required all 50 states to have structures involving in their health planning agency for the submission of proposals, and they needed to obtain approval for major capital projects and new high-tech devices. And back in 1974, a new high-tech device might have been a CT scanner or something like that. And those came quite a bit later. States have mostly retained their Certificate of Need program with mainly the focus on long-term care. That is the focus of most of them, and outpatient facilities. In 1987, the federal government changed their mind, and they repealed the law connecting Certificate of Need program adoption to the funding. And, 2016, I talked about that. 34 states, in the meanwhile, and the District of Columbia have some version of a Certificate of Need program, and another 3 states have something that's not called Certificate of Need, but it's a variation thereof. There's a really wide variety about what is covered in a Certificate of Need program. Oregon has a really low level. We only cover 4 programs, and we'll skip through this, but I do encourage you to take a look at it because you can see all of the states and what they cover. And they have, then on the tally list, you can see all the way from 30 different types of things are covered by Certificate of Need down to, 1, I think it is, in Ohio, but in Oregon has 4. So, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. So it's pretty broad difference between the states. And we'll skip on through that, and you can see the maps. Okay. And so the purpose of Oregon Certificate of Need, those statutes are there, so you can go ahead and refer to those. But the purpose of Certificate of Need is really to achieve reasonable access to quality health care at a reasonable cost, and that comes straight from our rule. The Certificate of Need is basically a regulatory program designed to discourage unnecessary investment in healthcare facilities, technology, and services. And the Certificate of Need is really one of the few ways in health planning that the government and the public, for that matter, have a say in the development of new healthcare services. The scope of review in Oregon is new hospitals and new nursing facilities and services and facilities. And so we don't cover bed additions for hospitals, so hospitals can add a whole new bed, they can add a whole new wing. There's a lot of opportunities. It's really a brand new hospital. And for example, they can add a rehab unit, they can add beds to their existing facilities, and they don't have to do a Certificate of Need. But we generally, when there's a replacement hospital, small critical access hospital, we do encourage every hospital to just write a letter of intent describing what they're doing to make sure that they have a certification that they don't have to have a Certificate of Need. So that's really most of the work that we do is saying that most things are not subject to Certificate of Need. One example of kind of some of the assumptions is if an MRI were in every single small facility or office, then there would probably be more MRIs being done. And that's one of those assumptions of Certificate of Need. New hospitals have a particular definition. It's really late, and I don't know if you want me to go through that. It's pretty complicated. But a new hospital is basically a brand new hospital that didn't offer inpatient hospital services on a regular basis in a specific service area within the last 12 months. So it's really, really narrow and focused. And they're initiating, or they're proposing to initiate such services. It doesn't include a whole bunch of things. I mentioned a few. The detail is actually in the in some of our administrative rules. So new nursing home is about the same. Nursing home beds, a new nursing home or subject to certificate of need is an increase in bed capacity, 10 beds or 10% of the existing beds. Rebuilding more than 50% or remodeling more than 50% of the nursing home. Relocation to a new site of the nursing home. And relocation of the beds from one nursing home to another. It's called bed shuffling, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute.
Is that covered or excluded?
Representative Greenlick, pardon me?
The last list, were they covered or excluded?
They're subject to certificate of need in those five cases, yeah. All right, quick history. Oregon's was established in 1971, and from 1971 to 1995, it applied to a wide variety of facility services and equipment, including CT scans and expensive equipment, and a lot of different things, new beds and the such. In 1995, the current scope was set, and the legislature opted to let the marketplace regulate most new healthcare services planning. The current scope basically ensures that new hospitals and new nursing home facilities, as defined as before, are needed, they're financially viable, and they're able to provide high-quality services. The current process allows for approval, denial, or approval with requirements or conditions. So one example of an approval with conditions would be the Kaiser Westside Hospital. According to their certificate of need, they were required to advertise in local newspapers and other types of media that they do provide services, emergency department services, to all comers. So they had to act, and that was a request of the affected parties in the area. Said when they build that Kaiser Westside Hospital that they actually do that, and then they report out to the Oregon Health Authority how that happened, and that worked really, really well. And then after a couple of years, we closed that out. So that was just a temporary change.
Are we holding questions to the end, or do you want us to?
Sorry?
Can I go ahead, or are we holding to the end?
No, go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Chair. So in the approval process of the application, I'm just curious, who approves the application when you say it's either approved or it's approved with condition or it's denied? Is it OHA that does that? Do you have a board that does that? What entity decides?
Representative Hack. Chair Greenlee, it is a process by which an analysis is done. It depends on if it's a nursing home or a hospital of full, but there's an analysis done. There's a review done. Either the conditions are met or not met, and that's determined. And there's a proposal, and that happens at the Oregon Health Authority. So that goes with it's all. There's no board. It's the Oregon Health Authority.
Who within the Oregon Health Authority? How many individuals? What's their background? What's the criteria of the folks that make that decision in the application? Who serves on that committee?
Representative Hack, Chair Greenlee. So it isn't a committee. It is the Certificate of Need Coordinator and the analysts that analyze that. And I'll talk a little bit about that when I talk about the process later, so I'll go over that. But so it is the analysts make a recommendation, and then it goes up through my office to the Public Health Division and then to the Oregon Health Authority Director.
Follow-up. So essentially,
let's hear where they're going.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, because I think we get to that in the last slide.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. There we go. Just a brief overview. Since 2007, two bills have been passed. One was in 2007, a certificate of need. The need to have a certificate of need was exempted for an Oregon veterans home, and that was passed. And then in 2013, House Bill 2216 passed, and that was a big medical assistance programs bill that included DHS's effort to do a reduction of nursing home beds by 1,500, and it goes from 2013 to 2020. It changed the definition of facilities that were subject to review and subject to expedited review. It was we work in partnership with DHS when these nursing home facilities come up, and I would defer to DHS for more detail about how that is going, because we don't have all of the data about what they've done and what changes they've made, because this was a small part of a large push of DHS to change things in nursing home bed counts. Move on to the next one. So the Certificate of Need program, it's supported by 0.75 FTE policy analyst and additional...
Are you going to talk about what's actually happened over the last period?
Yeah, Chair Glinick, members of the committee, I think at the end of this slide we kind of get into the number of facilities that have been approved,
let's go with
denied.
That.
Okay, so it's this slide.
Okay. I want to know the number that have been disapproved.
So here are the numbers, Chair Greenlake. So, yes, for nursing homes, 17 have been approved since 2006, and since 1995, we have had 7 hospital applications. 4 were approved, 2 were denied, and 1 is currently pending.
Which were the 2 hospitals that were denied?
Chair, denied?
Denied.
St. Helens and NewCo.
And what?
NewCo, Inc.
What's NewCo?
NewCo is...
The Wilsonville Hospital. The
Wilsonville Psychiatric, 100-bed psychiatric hospital.
The one that's currently in...
Cedar Hills?
Yeah. Representative, currently in Los Angeles. Cedar Hills is an existing hospital, and Universal Health Services, Inc. is the owner of that, and they requested a certificate of need for a second hospital in Wilsonville.
Tell me about the St. Helens one that was
disapproved. Chair Greeley.
St. Helens Hospital, which I remember why it was denied.
But the hospital in St. Helens that was disapproved, is that what you said?
Mm-hmm. Chair Greenlick, so... There's a detailed history on that is before my time, so I will I will say only what I know, which is that...
Good idea.
I know that it was denied, and it went and it came back again, and I think they had a second bite at the apple, and then it was withdrawn the second time. So it was denied, I think, for a number of reasons, and I really don't have them. I do talk a little bit about the categories that we have, and so
there's no hospital in St. Helens.
There is no hospital in St. Helens.
For Columbia County.
Representative Hack, why don't you go back to...
Okay, thank you. So I guess what I'm getting at is that it sounds like, and I don't want to assume anything, but that about possibly or potentially about 4 people have the say in whether or not a facility could or could not be given the application, approved or denied an application. When you talk about it goes through the analyst to the coordinator, and that concerns me.
I think if you could talk about one person.
Yeah, I mean, and essentially, true, Representative Hayden made a point that it may not ever even make it past the analyst. If the analyst says my recommendation is to deny, essentially one person could have a very, very significant impact on the application.
Yeah, if they ever did anything, that's...
So I guess, you know, and my concern would be should there be further conversation in, and I'd like some in-depth discussion or some maybe potential information provided by the department to tell me exactly what the process is. Does it go from this person to this person to this person and how that works?
Yeah, I think we need to spend some time thinking about this.
Yeah, and is there a potential for needing a board to take a look at this, an outside independent group of folks that have the qualifications to look at this as well? Because my understanding is if we look at this and we say the purpose is to, in your slide, it said the purpose is to offer quality health care at a reasonable cost, and that essentially very few people whom we're not sure what their qualifications are or aren't, have the capacity to make such a huge decision.
Representative Hayden, you have a comment in this area?
Just one question. Thank you, Greenlick, Chair Greenlick. What is the currently pending one?
Mental Health Hospital in Wilsonville.
Vice Chair Hayden, Chair Greenlick. So I'm going to answer your question, and I do want to get back to Representative Hack's question because I think I may have misrepresented what was. But the pending one is Lifeways, Inc. in Hermiston, Oregon.
Okay.
Hermiston.
Oh, there's another one besides the Wilson one.
And the Wilson one is denied into court.
Denied into
it's
court.
Denied. But there's a court challenge going on.
It was denied. Am I understanding on the basis that their application wasn't completed?
So, Chair Gernick, Vice Chair Hayden, so the initial application was denied. They are going through an appeals process. They have recently asked the agency if we'd be willing to enter into mediation with them over their current application. We informed them, I believe, last week that we were willing to enter mediation with them to discuss the application. So the initial application was denied, but there is kind of a follow-up process past that.
So we wouldn't consider that pending?
For this slide, we considered it closed, but denied, because the initial application is denied, but there's still a process going. The pending application is an actual application that no decision has been made on.
And that's in Hermiston? Yeah.
The other one's in Hermiston.
Very controversial.
The other one's in Hermiston,
Chair,
right?
Chair, Representative, the pending application is the hospital in Hermiston.
Which it doesn't have problems.
The application is currently pending,
but the application was not denied.
Yes, it is being reviewed. No decision has been made. The hospital in Wilsonville is included in the count of two that have been denied since 1995.
Okay, quick follow-up question. I noticed some legislation there. I introduced 3284. We didn't have the legislative appetite to discuss this, but maybe we will next time. Does the Oregon Health Authority, if you can, do you see any modifications that you could do, like expanding the board internally, or do you need that direction from us?
Vice Chair Hayden, if I could briefly talk about this slide and then talk about the process, I think it will answer both of your questions.
Okay.
And then,
so, all
right, I can do it. I can do it. Here we go. 30 seconds. Okay. So the certificate of need process is directed by rules, and there are many, many details about what the process is, what things are looked at, and they really guide them. They're basically the instruction sheet for how a certificate of need application needs to be put together, what information needs to be in there, and then how it will be reviewed, and it is reviewed as such. And the four categories of things that are looked at are general need resources, financial viability, and technical bed need, and architectural. And the process includes affected parties who are those who have a vested interest in this process, and that is determined by the Oregon Health Authority. It is not just for individuals that actually do this. This analysis is done by experienced experts. We have a financial firm that we actually contract with to do the financial analysis. We have a technical bed need expert that's been doing it for some 15 or 20 years. We have architectural review and construction plans review done by an architect. And then the general need and resources is done using those rules, and all of those details are in rule. And then that recommendation is made, and it doesn't ever stop at the analyst. So it never stops, and the analyst does make a recommendation. They look at the application and what has been submitted, and then determined can it be answered in the affirmative. I know that's a legal term, but that's what they use, and that's what it says in the rules. Can it be answered in the affirmative? Yes, they have met the expectations of the requirements, or not, and that's how that process works. So it's really quite nuanced, and I have about an inch full of rules that we use to do that, and that is done by experts. So it is an involved process.
Oh. Quickly, my point was that the final decision is made by the director. That's one person. Correct?
Justin.
Vice Chair Hayden, I'm not sure that that's a fair assessment of the process. If you've ever seen the 70 plus pages, it's very difficult it does go through a chain, and yes, it is with the health authority. It also has to align with the Oregon Health Authority's current policies. So the Oregon Health Authority has particular policies about hospitals, about particular services, about primary care and the like, and driven by the Oregon Health Policy Board.
It's a binary decision, yes or no. And ultimately, the administrator has the final authority to make that.
That's probably
is that
true.
Not right?
Chair Greenick, members of the committee. I think Dr. Sullivan.
Remember, you should only say something you know about too.
I would speak with knowledge. I think the number of people that are involved in the process and the number of analysts that are involved in, you know, basically saying whether or not the application has either met or not met the definition of the rules, I think that it comes in a strong definition. I cannot see a place where, you know, if an application met all of the criteria that is laid out in the rule, that the agency director would have the ability to override that.
Oh, I'm sure you can find out ways to make it happen.
Chair Greenlee and Vice Chair Hayden, I will say, may I say one last thing about that, is that there are requests for informal hearing. There's sort of an appeals cascade that happens through the administrative law and then on to the Court of Appeals. So there is a process, and if the analysis, the application and the analysis thereof determines a certain decision and then that is overridden, there is that process by which both the affected each one of the affected parties, and sometimes it's up to 10 affected parties, they do have the right to appeal that decision. So there is a process for not being satisfied with the decision.
So thank you, and I appreciate the clarity, and I get what you're saying. There's more than one that touch it. I think we all are just a bit concerned about those. But I think the bigger question or concern today may also be that, are we concerned about the idea that it may overall be ineffective in reducing health care costs when everybody yeah. else is saying that? And could that be the potential of it being ineffective and stifling a stifling innovation? So I guess for me, it's twofold. What are we doing? Is what we're doing right there? And two, overall, do we have an issue with the CON application, the need for it?
That's, I think there's a further discussion. To be continued.
Yeah.
So
the basic understanding that supply creates demand came from a 1958 study in Kansas City. And we've not really looked at that very specifically up to now.
But there are studies that show that in L.A., where they have an abundance of orthopedic surgeons, more orthopedic surgeries are done than
of
anywhere course. Else in the country.
Correct. Except in Bend, right?
He's gone. You didn't get one last job.
Chair Gruna, can I make one before you gavel us out here? I was supposed to say at the beginning of this, we gave you on OLIS for the previous panel, the 2016 key findings of hospital-acquired infections. We did produce a 2015 report that included a customer-friendly version, and we are, this week or next week, producing the 2016 version. So we will make sure that the committee gets that and the advocates also get it.
114 pages.
That will be the physician. It will be the actual hospitals and the rates they possibly
made. I have not seen it, so I cannot
That's
speak.
The way one online for 2014 looks like you can see that.
You want to comment?
Yeah.
So, now comment.